I think I am being followed. I am going to post you this film to make sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
Nobody cares about war criminals anymore.
Huh? You're still subject to law. They can be tried, and some have been quite recently.
If I refuse?
Kameraden have already decided. I have made the necessary arrangements.
You can't touch that money without my signature.
Hanaik is dead. Leider is dead now. You are the greatest liability for the organization, and you are still alive.
Yes, because you need my signature.
We depend on your loyalty, my dear Manfred. And it will be safer for Ingrid this way.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 12th of August, 2022. In the happy season, the silly season, the hot season, streaming live. Well, but we're another remote show because Martin is up in Herefordshire, away, having a nice holiday up there. And we are not actually in the studio, as you may be able to tell. We're doing another remote programme here in Bristol and in Herefordshire on the new talkradio.org.uk stream. Well, to be fair, it's really the old stream, but it's just got a name now, talkradio.org.uk. If you want to bookmark the stream we use live every week, that's the site, talkradio.org.uk. We're also being relayed by the lovely people at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. And we're live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Now, I just did get a message this morning saying that there's been some problem. Google seemed to have removed our app from their Play Store, but that this coming weekend, the app may be available at Apple. So not necessarily Google is your app store. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, that little box that gaslights us with military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare and COVID medical misinformation, where, by the way, an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily because they were denied treatment or lied to and told there was no treatment, that hydroxychloroquine, was no good for them, and that it was just a complete hoax. That was actually a lie, a deliberate lie, in order to kill people. And those London media lies apparently now all forgotten about, and everything's been brushed under the carpet because everyone's supposed to be talking about Ukraine now. Another wave of propaganda has taken over. Anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, we'll start just by asking you, before I run through some of the things on the show today, what you make of this idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, because it's being sold for the last 3 or 4 years to us as, hey, this is something really exciting, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, there's clearly is a technical revolution going on, particularly in AI, but they basically are saying that we're it. And that they're using the people behind the World Economic Forum, you know, the Western dominated elites that dominate the financial services industry and the military industrial complex. They see this industrial revolution as a solution to the world's problems, including, you know, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. In actual fact, it's more of the same. It's just the same old techno structure doing the same old stuff. And what we really need is a transformation, social transformation, to kick these people out of power. And well, they're not talking about that, are they?
No, we're not. And, you know, if we think about what they call the Third Industrial Revolution, what the rest of us just call the Industrial Revolution, mainly in the 18th century taking place. I mean, this is in England, mainly. This was a horrible thing for many people in Britain. I mean, they were basically herded out of the countryside into the towns and the cities, forced into these dark satanic mills. The idea that the Fourth Industrial Revolution is going to be somehow so much better. Well, it may be incrementally worse. But anyway, in the first part today, we'll be having a listen to begin with from Stand in the Pub on the cost of living crisis. That's a vox pop taken in Stroud this week, having a chat with some of the Stand in the Pub people about what they think about the cost of a living crisis. I mean, you can get quite a lot on talk radio. It's quite a lot of people been phoning in giving their thoughts about it, and actually a reasonable analysis from the Murdoch Empire, which is an amazing thing in itself, the way that the Tucker Carlson show and Steve Hilton over in the United States on Murdoch's Fox News have been exposing the Wuhan lab and the Pentagon programs there. Peter Daszak, Eco Health Alliance, actually basically some kind of military intelligence cover, developing nasty pathogens such as SARS-CoV-2 in order to spread them around the world. So the Murdoch Empire has been doing quite well, and also, of course, in Sky News Australia. And Murdoch does own Talk Radio and Talk Sport here in the UK, and Talk TV, which have been doing a good job. I mean, I hate to say this as a long-time journalist, like campaigning journalist, criticizing Murdoch over the years. Also, though, Stand in the Pub, we talk about social credit. We talk about this idea of banning livestock now, which is gaining traction, and it's caused all sorts of trouble, of course, over, as we were covering last week, over in Holland. And continuing the rural theme and the slightly sort of lackadaisical summertime lack of politics, I mean, steering quite clear in a way of this leadership debate between a lizard and a ventriloquist dummy. I mean, that's the way I see these two. I mean, we've had all sorts of other comparisons, but that's the way I'd characterize it. I'll leave you to work out which one's which. It's not that difficult. And so that is with something absolutely extraordinary. We had some clips from a few weeks ago from Jack Hargreaves, the out-of-town presenter from ITV Southern Region from the 1970s and 1980s. Well, we've got his son-in-law, Simon Baddeley, on talking a bit about Jack, but also giving us a bit of an insight into hunting. And we go down to one of the Devon agricultural fairs to talk to some actual farmers about, I mean, sheep farmers, this is what I was talking to, about what do they make of the idea that they will no longer be allowed to rear sheep anymore. We got some interesting stuff from the horse's mouth, from the farmer's mouth in this case. Also, Kevin Carhill is on talking about MK Ultra databases. He has just been involved in filing a new action against the National Security Agency for disclosure about the surveillance program, the mass surveillance going on in Europe. And he's done that in the Irish court, and he's got the European courts behind him. He's concerned about these databases where psychopaths are in one box, Jews are in another box, and someone somewhere is saying, well, we want to just target these people and these people. Well, of course, we know how badly that one went back in the 1930s with databases of Jews. And so this is why it's so relevant today. So he's got a new court action, Kevin has. Also, we hear about, upon a positive side, about new initiatives to do something about our privacy. This company called Generate, which was covered quite comprehensively on the BBC World Service this week. So we've got a clip from that. And new age trespassing in Berkshire on Minister Richard Bennion's estate. In part two, Scott Ritter, he's on talking about the weapons and money for Ukraine being siphoned off by organized crime, how much of what we're sending there, and why it is that the American government is complicit, because they don't care where it goes. In fact, they know it's going to go missing, but they keep sending it anyway. Also, last week's Annual Ministry Report, Scott's view on that, the use of schools and hospitals and human shields by the Ukrainian army. And he assesses what the Russians are doing in response. And most importantly, whereabouts might a nuclear war break out? Where's the most dangerous? From one of the experts who's written a book on the subject, I think it's called Scorpion King, about the nuclear arms race and nuclear weapons, Scott Ritter. Going on from that Hiroshima Day, we've got nuclear power, but not nuclear war, apparently, from Extinction Rebellion. And so we tease that one out. We talked about this briefly last week. But what is the actual thinking of activists on the ground up at Faslane who are part of Extinction Rebellion, but don't actually see nuclear power as having any role in the future because it's too tied to nuclear weapons, and also because of the massive pollution? Of course, we've had all sorts of warnings about droughts this week. And also we're going to have something at the end of the show about Rick Mayall's near-death experience, dying for 5 days, one Easter, and rounding off with some clips from David Livingston, well, about the usual stuff, which is things like Albert Pike, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, and the Book of Revelation. So that's David Livingston right at the end. I will start off by that, though, by saying it'd be lovely for people to pray for Roger Cook this weekend, if you can. He's got an operation. He's the guy that did the Cook Report. Many of people remember before, around about 2000, was doing some of the most fearless investigative journalism, journalistic stings as part of the Cook Report for Central Television. He'd before that been working for the BBC, showing up people. In fact, as Martin might remember, we covered this because he went into Boston Airport and he went into a New York airport too with some of his friends as part of this program in order to test their security. And they found they could smuggle all sorts of things onto the planes without any real trouble. And this was just before the 9/11 attacks. That film, although it was broadcast, then got burnt and lost, and the tapes disappeared, apparently, as well as an even more interesting one, which was about nuclear weapons, where Roger and his friends went over to Moscow in the 1990s, when it was all in a bit of a state of flux. Yeltsin was in power, and got offered SS-20 nuclear missiles. These are basically the Russian equivalent of the cruise missiles, which are over here, intermediate range missiles. And also, they also got given a sample of weapons-grade plutonium if they wanted to sell that on the open market. So if Roger Cook can get it, it makes you wonder why any other state in the world couldn't have got this stuff, because the Russian forces hadn't been paid for months, in fact, some of them years, and yet they were stood there guarding over the nuclear weapons bases. But anyway, look, let's start before we hear from the Stand in the Pub people, Martin. Let me get your view on the cost of living crisis and how the Tory leadership race is actually teasing this out, because they seem to be now admitting, even in these various polls, that actually nationalisation might be the answer, although neither Rishi nor Liz Truss has endorsed that yet.
No, and nor has Keir Starmer. But
what?
Keir Starmer's rode back on nationalisation, along with Rachel Reeves, which is why Audrey White had such a go at him in Liverpool. But of course, Gordon Brown has waded in this week, saying that ultimately nationalisation may be necessary. So he's hedged his bets, but he's definitely put it back on the table. And of course, windfall taxes, regulation, you know, he's basically put forward a fairly radical proposal, which I don't think he's cleared with Starmer's people before he put it forward. So I think Rachel Reeves isn't going to be happy with that, because she is really a neo-liberal.
So is Gordon Brown going to be sacked from the Labour Party now?
I don't think they can remove him from the Labour Party. I mean, obviously, he's not an MP anymore, so he's not really somebody that they have to take any notice of. But on the other hand, him speaking out like that has put Starmer on the spot. And of course, the fact of the matter is that even Tory members want nationalisation, never mind Tory voters, never mind the rest of us. And this is because they should never have been privatised in the first place. But you won't hear that from Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, who are both trying to channel the ghost of Margaret Thatcher, who put all these things into the private sector, even though it was the wrong thing to do then, and it's still wrong now. But in actual fact, there's never been much support for it. It's just basically come on by the financial services sector and the rentier class that runs our politics.
OK, well, we're going to carry on talking about this after we've heard from the Stand in the Pub group. Now, one of the things I love about Stand in the Pub, I mean, first of all, here in Bristol, it was so fascinating to see the way that the Stand in the Pub group was, first of all, taken away from the guy that originally started it by a small group. And then that small group were controlling it, absolutely controlling it in a very, you know, I turned up at one of the meetings, went over to one side and had a chat and did a live interview, as you might remember, about Ukraine with one or two of them back at the beginning of March. And I was then disciplined, you know, a little bit like the Labour Party are doing to people, by these rather jumped up individuals, three women, one who was the sort of behind the scenes running the Telegram group, and the other two who were sort of sitting in the group, gave me a sort of what they consider to be a disciplinary hearing, which I'm afraid I started giggling during it. And anyway, they decided I was, I couldn't be in the Telegram group. I was a terrible person of some kind. But anyway, it was interesting to see how something like that could be so controlled. And, rather than just allow people to come to a pub and have a chat, that, no, OK, we can't have somebody like Tony involved in this. We've got to get rid of him as soon as possible. Because, of course, I was there asking questions like, well, why have you got so many group meetings during the week? Why don't you just have one in a central Bristol? No. As soon as you start raising these questions, you're considered to be trying to control the group and being an interfering man, particularly. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to the much more reasonable and sensible, as many of the stand in the pub groups are. And by the way, they're mostly available on Telegram. Just be persistent and you can get onto one of the Telegram groups for different parts of the country. To the Stroud Vox Pops now, where we look at the cashless society and also a nation being plunged into debt.
I feel as though it's quite a leap towards restructuring of society into something more akin to a social credit system.
Tell us about this social credit system. They have something like that in China, don't they?
And India, I believe. Yeah. So it's more about programming money in a digital form. So whoever's giving it to you can decide what it can and can't be used for.
So say I want to go and buy a fridge. I might be told, no, you've got to use that money to buy bread.
Possibly, or you might be told where you can buy the fridge from or which fridge you can buy. But I think social credit could be broader than that. It could start to manipulate your ability or coerce your ability to travel to certain places or go about certain activities as well. I think the currency factor will be programmable, but it'd be part of a wider app, I feel.
An app? What do you mean? Something for your phone?
Something for your phone that allows you access to things and allows you to pay for things. But the what you could pay for would be programmed, and what you could access would be yes or no, based upon your score, which could be added to or taken away.
Do you think this is something for the UK or other parts of the world, or what?
I think that we may have aspects of it in the UK at first, and I think that COVID passports were off in that direction to a certain degree already, and that was a good practice, but it wasn't really received particularly well. Cashless establishments are moving in that direction. A lot of cashless establishments are contactless only now, so they're getting used to paying with an app. And talking about carbon credits and things like this are getting people into the mindset that their behavior might not be acceptable and they may need to be restricted in some way. So the whole thing's kind of coalescing.
What do you think about this cost of living crisis, a massive increase in the cost of energy?
If the wholesale price is remaining the same, but the cost to the person is increasing so much, is where is that money, additional money, going to? Is it either going to the provider of the energy, or is it going to a tax? So that would be my question about it.
I'll try and answer that, because we've seen record profits for both BP and Shell, four times more than last year in the last quarterly release. So the shareholders of these oil companies are quite happy about all this.
Yeah. So that in itself is very interesting, because that sounds like a classic example of exploitation. We are hopefully surrounded by various goodies who are going to stop the baddies from robbing people. But it sounds to me, if this is the case, then people are being essentially robbed of their own money by having to pay a vast amount more money than the wholesale price actually is. And no one's actually coming to their rescue, which to me seems strange. So are there no regulators or some such that might be able to help in this scenario?
I've got I'm afraid, some bad news for you, because we don't even have a government at the moment. We've got Boris Johnson on holiday and we've got nobody running the cabinet, seems to be sort of half asleep. And we're in the unenviable position of having the choice now between Rishi Sunak from the Treasury and Liz Truss from the Treasury and the Foreign Office about to take over.
There's a very big, big question there for people to make sure that the rule set that is being applied to their lives is something with which they personally can live. Because if it's appearing potentially that it's not something with which they can live, they're not going to be able to buy or trade or live in the manner that they're used to living up until now. And that's going to be a very, very big, big issue for people. But there's a secondary element to it. And I was surprised by this. I thought the social credit system only applied to people. It doesn't. It applies also to corporations. And so if people are being marked and scored on the manner in which they comply with a suite of regs and rules as dictated by or imagined by another, than corporations similarly. And so if we're thinking, you know, on the bigger macro kind of level as to what's really generating some of the really, really powerful messaging which is going on at the moment in respect of, for instance, carbon neutral, the ESG, the sustainability governance agendas. Someone has said that the problem is carbon, and someone has said that the solution to the problem being carbon is either to play nicely yourself personally or as a corporate to put that carbon back, or to play nicely by throwing some money to somebody else to tick that particular box about the carbon. But the important thing really behind this, I think, is the important part about any kind of rules-based system is who made the rule, what was the rule based upon, and are there any other stratification factors to that particular rule? So if we're looking to...
What's happening, sorry to interrupt you, but what's happening is a lot of stuff is being implemented that was actually brought into law years ago. If you look at history, we've been farming animals in this country for something like 4,000 years, and yet in 2023 we're being told no.
Why? I didn't get that.
If on the one hand we're being predicted famine, then why on the other hand would we not be motivating everybody to grow food and livestock and farming and produce as much as one possibly could? Because that's the antidote to famine.
I'm not a farmer, but I understand that we need animals on the land as part of managing the landscape for grazing and fertilizing, and it's part of the landscape management, whether we eat them or not. We could always have them as pets and to do their work on the farm.
So that's the Stand in the Pub group, and that just some of their various thoughts about all of this. Martin, what do you make of the enormous changes that seem to be being structured around this whole idea of zero carbon, zero nitrogen? We're being told that actually the whole world is a sort of toxic world we've created, although, of course, this is something that's been created by many of the same corporations who are telling us we've now got to change.
Well, what you might call corporate greenery, the World Economic Forum, you know, we've got to save the world and we're the people to do it, is very definitely a threat. But of course, we had quotes from George Monbiot the other week about how farming will have to go. I think that's an extreme view.
Livestock farming, let's just be clear.
Yeah, well, there's been an argument about livestock farming going on for decades. In the Amazon, for example, the clearing rainforest for beef ranching has been a big deal there for years. And of course, what they do is they also drive out the people who live in the forest. You know, the people who make a living by rubber tapping, for example. Chico Mendes was a rubber tapper, and he was assassinated by the big landowners in Amazonia because he was opposed to what they wanted to do with the land. But it's clearly not ecological, because the beef that they can only, because the soil is very poor, they can raise beef on it for, you know, a few years, and then it's no good, and they've got to go and clear another bit of forest to carry on doing what they're doing. Now, that is clearly non-ecological production of meat, largely, of course, for export, so that it can be eaten by wealthy people in the United States, not by poor people in Brazil. What they need in Brazil, what the Movimento Sem Terra have been saying for decades, is we need lots and lots of small farmers growing food to feed their families. And we don't, in fact, need the best land in the country to be used for beef farming for foreigners. And the same would be true in Zimbabwe, where in Africa, where the best land in the country is used for growing tobacco, which is in fact a poisonous drug, and the land was stolen from them.
None of this is really about I think what the rewilders seem to want to do here in Britain is to turn all of the grasslands that have for thousands of years been used for livestock here in Britain back to the sort of original forest.
I know that's what their goal is. And I think that there's, you know, you could argue that some areas should be left for original.
But, I mean, we can't eat acorns.
No, but I didn't say all.
I mean, maybe the forest would have to be just sweet chestnuts or something. But the idea that this is going to be able to produce food, they don't seem to care about that at all.
No, what used to be the case is that both left economists and green economists were united, and I still think this is obviously the way forward, is we need social justice in rural areas of the developing world. That's what all these big farmers protests were about in India, because they're basically moving to a more corporate system where they're not going to be guaranteed prices by the state, and the multinationals are going to control all the inputs and the outputs, and that's why they rebelled.
Look, surely, Martin, the main issue here in the West, and particularly in the UK at the moment, with our eyes on Holland, is that these decisions have been made as a kind of, this is a carbon policy, nitrogen or whatever. These policies have been made years ago, and when no one was asked, do you want to get rid of livestock farming?
The economics of farming, Tony. In actual fact, farming is a very, very regulated industry. You've got the Common Agricultural Policy, which, of course, Britain's no longer in, but we've got similarly regulated setup. The farming in Britain was, in effect, inefficient in global terms in the 1880s. It was run down completely, apart from the First and Second World Wars. It would have disappeared.
During the enclosures, Martin, during the enclosures and the agricultural revolution, what happened was most of the pasture lands or anything that was able to be pastured was turned over to sheep. This is a very cheap and efficient way of actually
making
efficient food.
It's not as efficient as you doing the same thing in Argentina or in New Zealand.
Look, we're not talking about Argentina. We're talking about Britain.
We're talking about the best use
of land in Britain. And you just seem to be just talking about abroad. Here, actually, if you've got land which is marginal, you can't grow crops on. The obvious thing to do is to put sheep on it, and this was done very, very efficiently in this country. Although obviously we don't have much of a demand. Martin, you've got to let me finish my sentence. We don't have much of a demand for wool anymore. There's certainly a decent demand for lamb, and it's a very, very labour unintensive. Thing to do. You just leave the sheep out there. What they do is they munch away for 6 or 8 months, and then okay, you've got some food, and they go to the slaughterhouse. Now, I'm not saying that this has got to be the way into the future. Nobody likes slaughterhouses, but this is a policy which is being foisted on Europe, maybe the States are too, but certainly Europe, without anyone ever being asked.
Well, hang on, Tony. There's a huge debate about whether farming should be subsidised at all, and if you're going to subsidise it, then you're going to decide what you want. Now, in actual fact, what's happening with marginal sheep farmers in Wales is they're being outcompeted. You know, the New Zealanders can actually sell cheaper stuff than they can produce. And also Brexit hasn't helped, because they now can't export to the European Union in the way that they used to. These are marginal farmers under any circumstances. Now, you may say that you want them to carry on doing what they're doing and you're going to subsidise them to do it. I might agree with you. But don't pretend that this is an economically efficient thing. The efficient thing, if you're going to follow through market logic, and I'm not a free marketeer, so I'm not arguing in favour of this.
It's just the best use of the land. It's the obvious use of the land.
I think we do need to have a farming industry in this country. We'll have to subsidise it, and we'll have to protect it, and we'll have to regulate it. But that means we can decide what we want to have. We don't need to have huge fields of barley barrens in East Anglia. That could all be turned into small farms using, you know, maybe small livestock.
That's actually an issue of ownership, not you.
Yes, but issues of ownership are fundamental when we're talking about all this stuff. We need a revolution, a social revolution, where ordinary people have access to land in Brazil, in Britain, everywhere, and that means the dispossession of the landlord class.
And in the meantime, we need to have a public discussion and a public debate and actually a democratic decision about whether we've decided we don't want to have any livestock anymore.
Martin, can we just move on? The issues about livestock, Tracy Worcester has been for years campaigning for farms, not factories. in the United States.
So you're going away from the subject again, because most of Tracy's Martin, you may not know any of this, but most of Tracy's work is around chicken and pigs, which are not like the sheep and cattle, which are
cattle in the US are similarly treated to pigs.
Well, this is Britain we're talking about again.
Yes, I know, but
talking about foreign countries all the time. We're focusing on Britain here.
Martin, we're focusing on Britain,
and I really wish you'd stop trying to talk over me the whole time. We're focusing on Britain because that's what this story is about, and that's what these people are about. We're talking about UK policy and whether UK farmers have to do this or not. And as part of my work on this and research into the topic, I didn't go to Argentina or the United States or New Zealand. I went to Devon to an agricultural show where I had a chat to various people about this. But I thought we'd start by getting a bit of a flavour of what these agricultural shows are like. There are various of them around the country if anyone is interested in taking the kids to them. They're great fun. And also you get to meet the country people direct. It's a kind of place where they like to showcase what they do. And also they network amongst themselves, have a good old drink together and talk about the sort of things I've just been talking about. And so we'll start, though, with, because one of the big traditional country things is dying now, and that's called hunting. So let's have a listen now to the hunting hounds and the horses in the ring, and a bit of commentary as they come charging around. It is a sort of, in a kind of heroic manner, but the idea is that this is one of the only times where all of these different Devon and Cornwall hunts actually get together.
So these hunts are run as subscription packs, and people will pay a subscription to ride with the hounds through the winter. And that is their fun. And the horse industry benefits so greatly from the hunting field. The breeding of horses is a big part of our industry, and we have many great breeders of horses, and those horses are made in the hunting field. To take a horse hunting, you have to be pretty well in control, and it's been a great learning place for all the hunts. And then if we could ask the bloodhounds then, if they could start to make their way around the ring, just steadily, and come up to the acting president, please. Hounds would be quite pleased to be out today. They're not in their season, they're resting at the moment. And to come to a show is a great treat for them. So they're just having a little sniff around and they're really enjoying it. Now we're going to ask the beagles, please. And so, if everybody has seen, Madam President, Madam Acting President, can we bring the hounds together? Good. Right, so hounds, please, to the centre of the ring, if you would, and whips in to take the horses away, please. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is a treat for all children, young and old. Please come in and meet the hounds. They're very friendly. They'd love to talk to you. Be careful with very young children, because hounds might just try to jump up. So if we could all come into the ring, please. Meet the hounds. Don't be shy. In you come. But please accompany any small children.
Yeah, so there's the a little sort of excerpt from the country fair. You mentioned beagles there, which are one of these dogs used for hunting. They're quite placid dogs. Amazing also to see this week a whole load of beagles were rescued from a research facility. They're arriving at shelters across the United States. This is something which has always exercised my mind, is the horrific animal abuse that goes on at Huntington Life Sciences. Of course, just like Sellafield changed their name from Windscale, so Huntington Life Sciences have also changed their name. But Martin, hunting is an interesting thing, isn't it? Over the years, it's changed. I think we might have even discussed this last week briefly, but the idea that hunting was originally of hares, boar, and deer, but then in the Industrial Revolution, it changed over to being mainly foxes. Anyway, look, we're going to hear another clip now from the fair, and this is the sort of meat of the issue, really, which is these farmers talking about, this is the Devon Agricultural Show again, talking about the idea of no livestock, see what they made of that when I asked them about that.
Well, I think it's absolutely ridiculous because the livestock, well, what sort of pollution do they do? They graze the ground and make it into meat, and then we live off the meat, don't we? What are we going to do if...
Yeah, what are we going to live off if we haven't got no animals?
Well, you can be a vegetarian.
Not everybody wants to be a vegetarian, no matter what you are. Some will, but not everybody.
You've got to grow crops for vegetarians, beans and things like that, which take fertilizer and area of ground. So I don't think you're going to gain anything by doing away with livestock anyway.
Yeah, well, it seems. I mean, that's what they're arguing is, well, actually, agriculture is the worst thing for the land. It's the biggest polluter.
When they're starving, that's when they'll want us back again. It'll be too late, won't it?
There's a lot of things against farming, but you see the country people, the people that have been here today to the show to see the livestock and everything, and I can't see that it's ever going to go away myself, because what Steve says, what's people going to eat now?
Yeah. So there's a few sheep farmers, at least I think they were. There was a whole load of sheep around them in little pens, some absolutely very, very fine-looking sheep. And this seems to be the way things are going, that there are policies to say that these sorts of things. The most interesting comment from them, Martin, is, look, what are people going to eat if there's no meat around? I suppose the answer, he maybe doesn't know about this, is Bill Gates's wonderful lab-grown meat. And I noticed another story this week that we've had the first, allegedly anyway, although I imagine it's been being peddled around for a long time on the black market, the first official shipments into Britain of lab-grown meat this week.
Well, I mean, the idea of getting rid of all meat production is clearly an extreme idea. And some people are putting it forward, but they're not the majority. And it's most unlikely that they're going to get their way. So in a sense, it's a bit of a straw man. The real problems with livestock farming is it's not viable under current economic conditions. And that's a problem. And the supermarkets, for example, screwing the dairy farmers and all the rest of it. And of course, if we are going to have all these trade deals with non-EU countries, Australia, the US, they are going to demand the access for their imports, which are not produced in the same way as ours, but they're a lot cheaper. Now, these are the issues facing farming. The fantasy that the World Economic Forum is going to come around and ban meat eating is very much a long way away. The real problems farmers are facing are economic problems.
Well, I don't think it's very far away in Holland. There's already many livestock farmers been driven out of a business by these policies, which are saying that they've got to reduce their herds. They're forcing them to, and if they don't, they get fined, and they get fined out of existence in Holland, which is why the Dutch farmers are getting so annoyed and why they're sending a message to us, which I've picked up on, saying, well, look, guys, you've got to keep an eye on what's happening here in Holland, because it'll be happening to you next. But look, the biggie at the back of all of this, Martin, is the general cost of living crisis we started with there, with the Stand in the Pub group. And this is about inflation. It's got to be, hasn't it? A lot of the inflation, I think, may be simply able to be put down to the increase in fuel prices, which affects everybody, and particularly the petrol and diesel prices. Almost everything is increased in price if you increase the petrol and diesel prices, and it's bound to cause inflation. And however much you may dislike the guy, Boris was pushing back against that when he was Prime Minister last year, and Rishi Sunak was pushing it forward. So what is causing inflation, Martin? Question number one. And is the quantitative easing continuing, or are we now seeing the tightening of the QE?
Well, it's a largely supply-side inflation, technically speaking. Sometimes inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods. That is one cause of potential cause of inflation. But other causes of inflation are when you've got production bottlenecks, where you've got shortages of key commodities like oil, gas, because that affects everything. And of course, what's forcing up the oil price is the international geopolitical situation and the decision by the Western powers to try and sanction Russian oil and gas. Now, if they didn't, if the Russians have basically said, we are prepared to sell you oil and gas at the same reasonable rates that we sold it to you before. We're not trying to cut you off. But if you cut off your own nose to spite your face, then there's not a lot we can do about that. And of course, what the elite in the West are trying to do is, as this crisis develops, it's going to start off with inflation and it's going to end with a depression, because they raise interest rates to squeeze out the inflation and then the economy crashes. And people are going to, you know, it's going to be the most serious economic crisis we've ever seen, more serious than the 1930s. And what hoping is that people are going to blame the Russians, when in actual fact it's their own leadership.
Well, I don't know if that's really working. They've seemed to have sort of tried, and it's been a bit of a damp squib. But what about the QE, though? Because this is quite important, isn't it? There were all sorts of dangers in doing this right the way from 2008. Many people said that, you know, the bailouts in 2008 said, look, if you're going to keep pumping QE in, your chickens are going to come home to roost at some point. And they're now talking about this QT, aren't they? Quantitative tightening. But they're not really telling us what they're up to.
Well, they don't know what to do. That's why, because they've got themselves into a mess that they don't know how to get out of. The QE was supposedly a temporary measure to preserve the banking system, and then it will be withdrawn. But it's like somebody being in a car accident, and then you start giving them heroin to control their pain, and then they get addicted to the heroin. And of course, everybody just presumes that we can have QE and it's not going to be any problems. But every time they've tried to take it away, the markets have panicked. The so-called temper tantrum of some years ago when they tried to stop QE. And of course, the Japanese have been printing money since 1989. They can't do anything else. There's no other option. And I think what will happen with QE is we'll carry on, because there isn't really any other option. Even the European Central Bank has now agreed that they're going to do it and all the rest of it. They'll carry on doing it until they can't. And what they won't be able to do it. The way it's been done is they've used it to prop up the financial services sector. That money could have been spent on ordinary people, and that would have made a lot more sense, but they didn't want to do that. But ultimately, of course, there's going to be a financial collapse, as there nearly was in 2008. But it's just going to be that much bigger. All you've done is made the bubble that much bigger, so that when it pops, it's that much more destructive.
Yeah, there seems and to that, be a terrific that's amount. Terrific amount of political correctness around. It's quite good to see Gordon Brown bucking the trend, talking about nationalisation. But over in Japan, I don't know if you saw that. I think the guy's name is Shinzo Abe, was shot dead just a few days after he'd come out as saying, well, we should not be helping the Ukrainian army. He was effectively saying, well, what the Russians were doing in the Donbass was understandable. And he ended up, didn't he, with a bullet in the head.
Yes, there's a very good account of that somewhere on Global Research, whereas it looks as if it's definitely a hit rather than just a random person. And it's because the masters of the universe in Britain, United States and Israel do not want anybody stepping out of line now. So that I think is probably what happened to Abe. I can't prove it, but people were saying that the police didn't do anything. The guy came from nowhere. There's a lot of suspicions about it. But, you know, Japan is an occupied country. I mean, it's occupied by the United States.
Yeah, no, Martin, apparently it's a democratic country and we live in the democratic free West. It's just that if you start to speak out and you've got access to the mass media, like a former prime minister does have, you get a bullet in the head.
Yeah, well, the thing is, he was quite right wing, Abe, but he was also a realist. In other words, he doesn't want to pick fights with China and Russia, which is quite sensible. I mean, who would want to pick fights with people? But of course, that's not good enough from the American point of view.
Anyway, staying on the farming and countryside theme, we're going to hear now from Simon Baddeley. And this interview, I've got a longer version, which I'll be putting up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He's Jack Hargreaves' stepson. Jack Hargreaves is well known as the presenter of Out of Town. There's some terrific videos of Southern TV, which are now coming back onto the market, having been recovered after having been lost for many years. of Jack's shows. And if you may remember the name Jack Hargreaves, you'll probably remember the children's program How. That's how I initially known about him. But you see, as we were watching How, which was all a kids show with Fred Dinage and others, who would just tell you how things worked and how they were done. It was a great little show, very interesting, and Jack devised it. But his main thing for the parents and our parents' generation at the time in the 1970s was this program Out of Town. So anyway, I asked Simon, Jack's son-in-law, a bit about Jack Hargreaves' spiritual side.
I think somebody said, I don't know, it was a very fine author, I forget what his name is, oh, bloke who wrote Flaubert's Parrot, he said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And then someone else said, Europe is got an enormous God-shaped hole into which every imaginable cult and lunacy emerges because of people's yearning for what you're describing. Now, there was a commandment which said, thou shalt not take the name of God, thy God, in vain. And this is one of the problems about talking about this subject, is that every time I've met people who have faith, I'm not talking about people who say, have you read this verse? And then you will understand, you know, who evangelize. I'm saying that actually discussing things spiritual is actually taking the name of God in vain. And I find that some of the most enjoyable people that I know, and lovely people I know, they don't talk about God. They just know that they know. And they might have a cross around their neck, or they might be some other religion and so on. But they tend to keep that to themselves, and they talk quietly about it rather than talk loudly. Don't get me wrong, because I think that German scholars in the 19th century did a fantastic destruction job on the Bible by going through all the texts and showing how they weren't true and that Christ may not even have existed. And if he did, the Christianity that we know only began to emerge about 1,000 years after Christ, and so on and so forth. So I can understand why people have moved away or moved to, but well, it's a vast discussion and I can't say anything very wise about it.
Well, I got the sense from Jack that he had some faith, but that he didn't want to really talk about that directly to the viewers, but that he wanted people to sense it from the way he
said, I don't believe in hell. I don't believe in hell, but it terrifies me. Because, you know, his early upbringing. And I'm absolutely imbued with the Christianity that I learned from childhood, not from my parents specifically, but from school. And I love the stories and I love being in churches. And I spend a lot of time in Greece where I have no comprehension of the liturgy, but then most of the churchgoers don't either, because it's in a form of Greek that is not generally understood. But I've always been welcomed in the Greek churches, and we're allowed to take communion there. And I enjoy the presence. But Jack said,
"I'm a fellow, right.
If I had any religion in mind, I would be a fellow traveller of the Quakers, because what they said is my conscience is the only thing that concerns me. I do not concern myself with other men's consciences."
Simon Baddeley there, who's the Jack Hargreaves stepson. It's quite lovely to catch up with Simon because he's involved very much in the release of the old Jack Hargreaves DVDs. And in fact, in his garage, he's got a whole collection of films, because that's what they used to do in the 70s. They'd go out and film. And the way Jack made his programs was very much not the way they do it today, in this kind of, you know, the countryside programs, country file style. They would just go out and film, and they wouldn't record any pieces to camera or whatever, just film what they were up to. They'd put together that film into maybe 5-10 minutes of footage with a bit of maybe bird sounds or whatever, a bit of wild track, as we call it, and then Jack would just talk over it, and that would be the program. But he would talk at the start and the finish, and I don't know if you remember, Martin, he used to talk in his woodshed with all these woodworking tools all around him, behind him. Do you remember that program at all?
Well, no. I mean, obviously, you've been unearthing aspects of it in the last few weeks, and that's the first time I'd ever come across it.
Okay, so, well, here now, second clip from Simon Baddeley, and that is one of the interesting factors about all of this is it's looking at countryside history, why we do what we do. We've just gone through a decade or two decades where fox hunting has been banned. But I find very strange. Why were we hunting foxes anyway? I thought hunting, as we just heard from the agricultural fair, was all about, originally back to the old hunter-gatherers, chasing game, you know, to eat it. This is surely what it's about. This is initially anyhow. So let's have a listen to this, because apparently it changed. After the enclosures, after the English Civil War, a very important point in history, world history, as well as English history, is we got a new bunch of people coming into the countryside, the merchant classes. They'd managed to evict, and we're going to hear a little bit more about that in a minute. They'd managed to evict thousands of people from the countryside in the enclosures. So you had all these kind of tumble down empty cottages, more and more people available for the dark satanic mills to fill them up. And those old cottages that we see, you can see many parts of Britain, particularly places like Leicestershire, Northamptonshire, lots of these empty villages where you can just see the print of the village on the field. So you can see the old footings of the houses or whatever. But the stones from these old cottages were used to build many of the new country piles, and so it was a whole new manor houses and things. So a whole new bunch of people took over in the countryside. I mean, a little as we've seen with the Jack Hargreaves programs, a new wave of people from the big cities taking over property in the countryside as they retire or as they get a bit more wealthy, and then commuting in by train. So the changes that are going on now. But what Simon was talking about was the difference between the fox hunting fraternity after the enclosures, after the Civil War, that is to say the merchant classes taking over, and before that, where it'd been actually mainly a feudal thing, and that the hunt was out there to get deer, boar and hare.
There was venery that the aristocracy did, which was to hunt for deer, wolves, wild boar, and the hare. They were considered honourable enough for the royalty to, and they had areas that they protected in the most violent and oppressive way from ordinary people being involved. And then with the with the coming of the Industrial Revolution, a whole new body of wealth, the bourgeoisie, began to arrive and wished to follow the, they bought estates, they bought big houses, and wanted to follow the hunting habits of royalty, well, as aping royalty in all sorts of other ways. And one of the most fascinating things was that the game that royalty had pursued was to eat, as you say. And of course, because it was to eat, that's why they were so violently opposed to those who wanted to share that food. So, by those people who poached, so you could be hung for stealing one partridge, one rabbit, even. Although rabbits actually were a bit outside that, because they were outside what royalty was. But the penalties were ferocious. And it's why the Normans refer to the food that they chased in terms of, we call it beef, beef, because they actually ate, it wasn't cows, but and deer were venison, because these were things that they ate, and they called them by the names of the meat, whereas the ordinary people would call them by the names of the animals that they were.
So how did we get to the foxes, though?
Well, the fox became something that somebody, I don't I don't know how it actually started, but it became something that could be chased because it was regarded as a pest because it killed chick, fowl, and so on. And as I understand it, fox hunting is only about 300, even 250 years old, and it was spread with enormous success all over the country. Became extremely prestigious and was part of the social life of the country, but and developed all sorts of strict rules and hierarchies and rules and so on. And I hunted a few times in my late teens and early 20s and really enjoyed myself, although we never killed. One of the things about hunting is it's an enormously ineffective way to kill foxes. I think I might have mentioned that to you. I think the reason that the people who dislike hunting with the intensity that they do and helped to bring in the legislation that banned hunting just could not cope with an idea that it might be fun, that it might be exciting, that it might be interesting to ride headlong across country in all weathers, get covered in mud, enjoy the company of other riders, the horses enjoying themselves as well. I remember the killing of the fox was almost irrelevant to the fact it was so good to get up early in the morning, saddle up, ride 3 or 4 miles to the meet, maybe longer at times, bloody cold, and then off you go, and the hunting goes on till it gets dark in the winter, and then you come back covered in mud, make sure your pony's looked after and foddered and all the rest while you're still shivering with cold and longing to be. And anyway, make sure the horse is fine and then go indoors and have a nice hot bath. And nowadays it would be a glass of malt whiskey by the hot bath and then sit by a warm fire. Wonderful way to to spend a winter weekend.
Well, that's Simon Baddeley there, reminiscing about hunting, but it is something which is pretty much being stifled out. And in fact, even under the Conservatives, there was some, Martin, that was saying that the Tories would bring it back. No, they haven't, have they?
Well, that's because if the opinion polls are right, the vast majority of people don't approve of it. And that's why it was eventually forced to the margin. I think they do still hunt, actually, but the hunt saboteurs are trying to get various hunts prosecuted. But if you look at the opinion polls, no serious politician is going to bring back hunting because the opposition to it is overwhelming.
It's also this kind of revering of animals, which is the theme over the last 20 minutes or so here, which is, this kind of anthropomorphism, that humans are animals. This is something that Yuval Noah Harari was talking about, Martin, wasn't it? I wonder whether this isn't just a sort of, pantheistic agenda here, that which is saying, nobody likes the idea of killing animals, but it looks as if there's a sort of a general idea out there that animals are actually equal and up there with humans now.
Well, I think, is it Peter Singer, the philosopher, who wrote the book about, what we owe to animals? And British society in particular, with the Royal Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and so on, even in the 19th century, British culture is in fact quite sort of pro-animal compared to other countries like France or Italy, for example, where they shoot songbirds. I mean, that's been unthinkable here. But that's what they do. They go out every Thursday. They have rules about it, and they shoot all these little songbirds, which in Britain would be regarded as absolutely outrageous. I think this is why fox hunting has been banned, is because of that kind of sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, in a
way,
it's
widespread.
What's happened is that we're quite happy to take our little chunks of meat from the supermarket in a polystyrene plastic package, but we don't really want to think about what's been going on in the slaughterhouses.
Slaughterhouses have been regulated, as you know.
We don't want to think about it, Martin. This is what I'm saying, is it's something which people don't think about. And as they've not thought about it, you know, we're now being kind of told you've got to think about it, and many people don't like what they're seeing. But I mean, there's not a proper, all I'm saying is there's been no proper public debate. One thing there has been is a nice mass trespass this week. Again, I think this is by a kind of new age group of some kind. It doesn't say who they are exactly. But this is trespassers demanding the right to roam on a minister's 12,000 acre estate. Campaigners have visited a Berkshire estate belonging to Richard Bennion, the minister in charge of access to nature. It's hard to know what access to nature minister Richard Bennion normally finds in his gigantic Berkshire estate when he strolls out on a Sunday afternoon. It's unlikely to be a loudly singing group of activist trespassers dressed as psychedelic animals and accompanied by an all-female Morris dancing troupe. And that's what you get nowadays with the mass trespass, is the this sort of new age thing. Anyway, that's what wandered up his drive last Sunday when protesters visited his Englefield estate. Martin, it is brilliant in a way that what these people have done is they pointed out that this access to the countryside minister, he's now a Lord, he's a former MP, Tory, obviously, he's been stopping up footpaths.
Yes, and of course, in Scotland, the Scottish government has brought in right to roam. So you can go anywhere, you know, within reason. You are, you know, the special scientific interest areas, like don't go in there because you're going to disturb the butterflies. But you're allowed to wander. And of course, the land ownership in Scotland is very skewed. There's a very small number of people own most of the land, but people have access to it because that was part of, you know, radical Scotland's self-image. Whereas in England, of course, the landowning classes are very firmly in control and you're not allowed to go there.
Anyway, I spoke this week. We're going to hear in a minute from Kevin Cahill about his legal action he's taking to force the police to hand over mass surveillance data and to force their, well, actually to force the police to force the tech giants, to be precise. But while I was speaking to him, I also asked him about the Richard Bennion trespass in Berkshire this week.
Made me feel very guilty, because I didn't realise how big his estate was. No, he was an MP for quite a while, and he's put into the House of Lords by Johnson, and now he's in charge of public access to land in England. And he has 13,000 acres in Surrey. Now, we had him in the rich list at, you know, 100 million-ish, because we didn't have any idea how big the estate was.
Oh, it's actually in Berkshire.
In Berkshire, rather. Sorry, did I say Surrey? In Englefield. It's just there by the river, just by Runnymede. In fact, he might even own Runnymede. But, no, the estate covers that corner of the home counties. But whichever way, we thought he had a couple of thousand acres. We didn't know he had 13,000. That's a huge estate, even, you know, in a country full of big estates. The second thing was, if we had valued him properly, he'd have been up amongst the serious billionaires. Well, think of it, 13,000 acres of Berkshire, Surrey.
But how can the minister in charge of access to nature be stopping up footpaths? That's what he's been doing on his estate.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he's done that. But it made me think historically that the greatest crime in English history was the enclosures. That's where his estates came from. They were created during the enclosures.
Yep, here we go back to the enclosures again. Yeah, Martin, these Tory landowners do rather take the mickey, don't they? First of all, they're pontificating about everyone's got to have access to nature, and then they're blocking off their own massive estates, which they stole hundreds of years ago, or their ancestors did.
Yes, and as I say, in Scotland, they've taken a more radical view. They passed their right to roam legislation in memory of John Smith. And of course, you know, the right to go on climbing up mountains in Scotland is regarded as very much, you know, we're going to have it.
Well, I know, but it's not the same as it's not giving access to farmland and woodland.
No, like, no, you can go anywhere, provided you don't cause damage. And that's what these protesters in England are demanding. They want similar laws here to allow people access to land, provided they don't cause damage.
Obviously. Well, you know what? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because right at the same time, the landowner lobby in England has been clamping down, for example, on just simple gypsies and travellers. I find it hilarious the way the hypocrisy of these Tories, particularly Priti Patel, in the traveller clampdown, and they're saying, oh, but we need, you know, cheap labour in order to do these seasonal jobs. Well, hang on a minute. The travellers, the gypsies used to do that. You know, sometimes it was people from the East End of London, etc. But what you've done is you've criminalised the people that used to do things like the fruit picking at this time of year, haven't they?
Well, the kind of farming that they're doing now around here in Herefordshire, soft fruit farming, they didn't used to do it back when I was a teenager. I used to work on hop harvesting here. Just when I was at college, it was a holiday job, and guys from Wales would come over, mostly actually on the dole in Wales. So they'd just slip over the border to earn a few quid doing the hop harvesting. But what's happened now is you've got quite extensive soft farm production around here, and it very much depends upon seasonal labour that comes in from abroad, because the amount of money they pay is so low. But if you come from Bulgaria, that amount of money is quite useful when you take it back to Bulgaria. But of course, for Britons, it's peanuts, and they don't want to do it. And it may well be as a result of all the things that, you know, what's happened with the East European exodus post Brexit, is that a lot of these farms are going to fold because they can't get the labour they need to do on the business model that they're functioning under.
Well, they would be able to if we had plenty of itinerant workers. This is just a good thing in any civilised society. Anyway, look, let's just go on to talk to Kevin, or hear from Kevin, about his concerns about privacy. We're going to also hear this report from the BBC World Service about privacy, which is actually much more on the positive side about what can actually be done, business models, in order to break the power of the big tech giants. But I first ask Kevin about data manipulation, before we hear from him about his legal action he's started this week, about the manipulation of data, why it's so dangerous. The idea, of course, here is that you've got in these massive profiling operations which are going on about with the whole of humanity, obviously starting with mostly with people here in the West. This is exactly what the Nazis did. Exactly what the Nazis did. Are you listening, world? In the 1930s, by putting everybody in Germany into these IBM Hollerith databases. So they had little punch card machines with everyone in Germany. Everyone was registered. They willingly said what their religion was. They didn't realize that if you had admitted to being Jewish, in a few years' time, it might mean you get a knock on the door and you get stuck in a concentration camp, or worse, or far worse than that. But anyway, I had a chat to Kevin about what he thinks is going on with modern data manipulation by these tech giants, and also how he links it to the old mind control CIA MK Ultra program.
The manipulation is invisible. Obviously, I wouldn't know if I was being... an ordinary person would not know. The manipulation is group. They group a bunch of people and they say they've all got the same characteristics, so we'll push these things at them. Now, two of the things I think are happening because of this. One is the catastrophic rate of gun murders and gun suicides in the United States. The country most affected directly by this is the country in which the criminals are resident. You know, 45,000 Americans were shot dead. 50% were suicide and 50% were homicide.
I mean, what's so worrying about this? I mean, you're talking really here about profiling and putting people in databases, in boxes, basically, to do with kind of a person they are. Now, two things come to mind immediately. Is it's extremely concerning that you might have a sort of database of 100,000 psychopaths, or you might have a database of 100,000 Jews, and then decide what you're going to do with those people.
That's one of the data they're most interested in is damaging data, you know, vulnerabilities, people who are psychopaths, this is what they look for. And of course, it would be very easy to line up the people who are Jewish, because you can pick it up really easily. But the big catastrophe, and America doesn't seem conscious of it, is that the scale of gun deaths in the United States is higher than in the worst of the Vietnam War. And nobody seems, you know, it's kind of, oh, that's just how things are. Well, it isn't. I have a suspicion, I reflected it to you in my thing, that the criminals, the big thing they're doing is in the United States against the American public. Mm. Do you ever remember McCultra?
MK Ultra?
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yes, of course, yeah. Mind control.
Yeah. Well, this was the CIA spraying people in the street with LSD. And lots of people went bananas and people committed suicide. This was the effect, because you're walking along the street and you get a face full of LSD. Well, you obviously haven't a clue what's just happened to you. You're seeing a lot of bright lights. And a number of the people affected by McCultra, the McCultra experiment, committed suicide. And this looks like a digital McCultra experiment.
That's Kevin Cahill there with a rather a sinister concept. Digital MK Ultra with Mark Zuckerberg running it. And he takes his orders, of course, from Yuval Noah Harari, the great prophet of Bill Gates, of Elon Musk and the rest of them who can't think for themselves. They just parrot everything Yuval Noah Harari says. Anyway, Martin, it is worrying, these massive databases and the parallels with the 1930s. This should be being screamed out from the rooftop, surely.
Yes, and in actual fact, in the US Constitution, and it was written into the Constitution, they're not supposed to interfere with any kind of private communications at all. You've got to have a legitimate criminal reason. In other words, you've got to have a warrant from a judge, or there's got to be a legitimate national security reason. So, but because they were able, the NSA, through the tech giants, were able to carry out this mass surveillance, they just did it, even though it was unconstitutional. And of course, they've been doing it for years, and they're trying to, you know, bamboozle the population to believe certain things. And of course, MK Ultra is an even dirtier end of this, where they're trying to develop techniques of mind control and so on. I mean, there's a lot about this in Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. But it's gone way out of control. But what's interesting about Kevin's court cases that he's been pursuing is that the NSA, because it's a national security agency, can't be sued for doing this. But since they did it through these private corporations as a front, the private corporations can be sued under civil law. And if everybody sues them for invasion of privacy, they could potentially be bankrupted. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, because they've got plenty of power to prevent that sort of thing happening. But they shouldn't be carrying out mass surveillance of the population. That's why Edward Snowden whistleblew on that, and why he's now living in Moscow, because he can't live in the West, because he's a wanted man, because he blew the whistle on what they were doing. They're basically keeping an eye on everybody, and as part of basically controlling the population. I mean,
it's more than that, isn't it? It's more than just keeping an eye on people. It's profiling people. It's putting them into boxes with millions of other people of different similar qualities, whether it be their faith, whether it be their political persuasion, or even possibly, you know, their height. It could be sort of just physical stuff about somebody's, you know, they can do whatever they want with
the computers. Allow in the past, they could. I mean, the Stasi, you know, in East Germany, they basically tried to, you know, but virtually everybody was, lots of people were Stasi agents. They had their fingers in all over the society. But the problem they had is they didn't have the computers we've got now, and they could collect all this information, but you'd still have to sort through it all and decide what was important, what was not important. The computers allow them to, the computer sorts it through it for you. Say, find all the people here who voted for Sinn Féin. Click, they all come up. just like that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. This is Palantir, and these various systems which have been developed by Bilderbergers of various times, Peter Thiel, etc. And those are almost sort of digital interfaces for controlling people's minds. Anyway, when Kevin was talking about the thing I sent you, he was referring to he sent me a copy of this legal action addressed to the Honourable Congressman Adam Schiff, Chair of the House Intelligence Committee of the Congress of the United States of America. He's being very polite, copying it into them. But actually what he's doing is he's doing it through the Irish courts, carried out by the nine criminal corporations: Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google, Yahoo, YouTube, Skype, AOL, and PalTalk. Acting as agents for the U.S. National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland. Only these criminals indicted in EU courts so far are named. So what he's saying is they are engaged in mass and indiscriminate criminal surveillance throughout the European Union. So I'll put a copy of the thing that Kevin has sent up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, along with this interview too, the full version of the interview with Kevin. And we're going to hear the final clip from Kevin now, which is where he explains what he's doing through the courts here. That is the legal action.
They used to run a lot of conferences, which were never reported by anybody, including The Guardian. And I would tell the peers what was going on, which they weren't being told by the government. You know, the government was lying through its teeth. And the peers I worked for would periodically, you know, raise issues, raise questions. And it blew up when Edward Snowden in 2013 made all those revelations about what the Americans were really up to. And they were spying in the House of Parliament. Microsoft were. Now, this is a matter of public record. In September 2007, the National Security Agency and Microsoft jointly imposed mass surveillance in the United Kingdom. It's in the legal record. It was a judgment in an Irish court, and then it was the judgment of the European Court of Justice. So, you know, there's no kind of factual argument. This is what they were doing. And nobody did anything. The Information Commissioner, you know, who was on the side of the surveillance parties, never brought a complaint against any of the people named by the courts as doing this criminal surveillance.
Yeah, so Kevin is now forcing the issue through the courts. We'll keep you obviously reported on how he gets on, bless him. But as a sort of side adjunct to that, of course, this gets very little coverage around the world in the media properly. This is a question that none of the journalists seem to want to ask: is are we seeing another Nazi Germany style situation develop with all this information being gathered on everybody? But there is a group, and the guy's name is Sam Jones from Generate, who have been looking very, very carefully at privacy. Ed Butler is one of the presenters on the BBC World Service's Business Matters. And Sam Jones was very successful at the Dragon's Den, which is a program I detest. But apparently he managed to squeeze, I don't know, was it about £60,000 out of as an idea to start a business around protecting people's privacy. So let's have a listen to Ed Butler interviewing Sam Jones on the BBC World Service programme Business Matters. Again, I'll put the full version of this show up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Actually, not the full show, but the full item, because it's quite a long item. But here's an excerpt where Ed talks to Sam about this Generate company, which is designed to offer people the opportunity to opt out and keep their privacy rather than hand it all over to the likes of Bill Gates and Zuckerberg.
Right now, as a consumer, we all trust our bank, and we know that we can leave all of our money in the bank, that the bank will put our money to work for us, and at the end of each month, we get a little bit of something back in return via interest. What I believe is that in the near future, there'll be a company or potentially companies that we trust with our data, put our data to work for us, and we'll get something back at the end of the month. So ultimately, that's what we've built with our Generate Data Wallet. And the idea is really simple. A person downloads it, it's totally free. And then we say, okay, do you use Google or Facebook or any of these big tech companies? If you click on Google, we will then download all of the data that Google hold on you. And by the way, it's nuts what they have. It is every search you've ever made online whilst logged in, every website you've ever been to, every advert you've ever seen. So we show you that info and we say, you know what? If you're uncomfortable with this, if you want to remove it from Google, click here and we'll delete it. Or if you want to get something back, click here, share it with Generate. We will anonymize it and we'll put it to work on your behalf so that you are rewarded anytime your data is used.
That is the core concept of Generate.
Exactly. We build technology that empowers people to control or earn from their data.
Obviously, the argument behind digital advertising is that, listen, this is everyone wins. We are simply getting better at targeting the right products to the people who are most likely going to want to buy them or use them. And therefore, we're saving everyone else from the kind of a wall of nonsense that perhaps has nothing to do with them. We are simply delivering the appropriate products to the appropriate subgroup.
And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I am agnostic with regard to is tracking good, is tracking bad, should we use data, should we not use data. But what I do believe is that people should have a clear and transparent choice. That someone, if they're uncomfortable with this, in one click by choosing privacy mode, they should be able to stop it from happening. Or if you are okay with this principle, if you don't mind being sold online, then we believe that you should have the ability to A, have more control about what information's out there, but B, have the ability to get something back yourself should you want to. And that's the premise for our whole business.
Do you imagine further down the track that that's going to expand, that maybe Google and Facebook, or at least some of those ad exchanges, are going to be coming to you to pay you directly or the consumers for data?
So we believe that we are fundamentally working on a paradigm shift. We're trying to change a model to rebalance it in favor of consumers. And of course, as a business, we also need to ensure that we have the commercial partners and the commercial backing to make this financially viable. So we are playing the long game. We're building something that we believe can fundamentally have a major impact. And if we succeed, we will change people's relationship with their data and therefore, in a small way, change the world, the way that the world is spinning.
So if you're right, if there is a paradigm shift going on, what will it look like? What will the future 10 years down the track be in terms of the relationship between our data and all of those companies? There's thousands of companies, and particularly with Google and Facebook and Amazon at the top. How will we relate to them?
Very simple. Firstly, the majority of these businesses who you've never even heard of, but right now hold your data and sell it, they will cease to exist. Step one. Step two, the companies who do hold your data, you'll be aware of them. Like right now, if I stop a man in the street and I say, who has your data? They can't tell me. I work in the industry and I can't tell you. This is nuts. So I think if we look to the future, it isn't hard to imagine a scenario where actually everyone has an app on their phone. And perhaps even as part of the first time they start up their phone, the very first question is, what do you want to happen to your data? You understand what data is where. You can retract that should you want to, or you can get something back from it if you'd like to as well. And that's where I see the world going.
Well, that's certainly an interesting contribution. And I hope, we all obviously hope that this is a successful business. At least he's got the money to get it going now, Martin. Interesting that you can get potentially make money out of working for individuals in order to guarantee their privacy, or at least they've got some choice over their privacy, up against the massive force of these tech giants. It's brilliant that someone has actually come up with this, and I hope he manages to live to tell the tale.
Yes, well, I mean, it's not just an economic issue, is it? If you've got the National Security Agency behind these tech giants that want to use the gathering of data in order to program the population for war and all the other things that they want to do, it isn't just a question of business ideas, is it?
Are you personally, do you mind about your own, do you think much about your own privacy or not?
I think if you're going to use any kind of electronic devices, you've got to accept that you're anybody can hack in, and even illegally they can hack in. The government may be watching you, everybody be watching you. The only way round it is not to use electronic devices at all. And of course, this is one of the things that the Taliban did in Afghanistan. You just throw away the mobile phones and just do it all through word of mouth. And that, of course, completely defeats the electronic warfare capabilities of your enemy. But that's the only way to do it.
It is. Yeah, well, maybe potentially is anyway. I mean, I wonder whether, is this legal? I mean, what we've got is, it certainly when I was starting in journalism back in the 1980s, late 80s and early 90s, we understood as journalists, we had all sorts of special protections from surveillance and that the police couldn't just, or MI5 couldn't just keep an eye on us because they didn't like us, that they'd have to go to court, etc. It seems now that none of these surveillance methods people have to go to court for. And of course, it's quite possible for somebody that has something against you to simply pay the tech giants a load of money to get all your data, all your personal private data.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that although in the US Constitution, as I mentioned earlier, they're not supposed to interfere with private communications, that doesn't apply to foreigners in other countries. So they can spy on everybody in the world legally because they say that they can. Now, in actual fact, this is against EU legislation on data protection. And I think that this is what, you know, what Kevin has managed to do with the court case that he's managed to get going with, I believe it was an Austrian student who first got this ball rolling, is that in actual fact, there is no legal basis for the mass observation of the population that's already taking place.
Well, it'd be very interesting to see if
they haven't got a legal leg to stand on.
If the European courts actually do anything, because, of course, he's already brought an action in the European court. And if you have a listen to the full interview, Kevin explains that the European court, what they did is they only ordered, this is, I think, an Irish version, I'm not 100% sure, but anyway, whoever it was, a European jurisdiction court, what they said is they asked various police forces in the UK to investigate this. But the wording was such that they were asking the police forces, they got letters back from the police forces declining to, and so this new court case is instructing the police. So the judge will instruct, hopefully, the police to do these investigations, and let's hope Kevin has the very best of luck with that. In the meantime, we've got all sorts of other trouble, haven't we? And that's normally what we look at here, various problems that are being not dealt with, or this one is an absolutely, I think, colossal one. 1,350 empty properties. We dealt with this story back in May when ITV West covered it. Empty properties owned by the Ministry of Defence, or I think actually now owned by some private company. The Ministry of Defence have privatised them too. And we're going to hear now from the leader of Wiltshire County Council, that is Richard Clewer, who is himself a former army officer, at talking about what's happening with these 1,350 empty homes, some of which are in devices, as they put in the. And what I'll do is I'll put a link to the clip. And in fact, I'll probably put the clip up on the show page to this ITV report. It's shocking. In fact, maybe before we hear from Martin, there doesn't seem to be any accountability here with the Ministry of Defence. This has been chugging on for years. Some of these properties empty up to 10 years. Worth something like £200,000-£300,000 a piece, empty. And now, obviously, with 10 years of disuse, they're starting to, some of them, become uninhabitable.
Yeah, well, I remember when you covered this story some weeks ago, didn't we? It's shocking. I mean, it's just another example of the high-handedness of the MOD. And, of course, the role of the private sector. They've now farmed off what these houses belong to us. The Ministry of Defence is a public institution, but they are basically giving it to a private sector firm to manage. And then, of course, they say, well, there's nothing to do with us now. They're managing it. And therefore, there's no accountability. They've just been given public property. It's outrageous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something called the DIO, the Defence Infrastructure Organisation. But there's no accountability there. They just do what they want. There's also, of course, the fact that these properties are sitting on land. That land may be simply seen in some people's eyes as just a land bank. Those houses, once they start to deteriorate, maybe then they'll have to be demolished. And maybe there'll be an intensive housing estate, maybe three stories with some blocks of flats and things put on there. And they're just thinking, well, you know, if we wait long enough and these houses fall down, then we can make a lot of money here. But anyway, let's have a listen to Richard Kluwer, the leader of Wiltshire Council, explaining earlier this week to me why we've still got these 1,350 empty homes and nothing's being done about it.
There are always going to be the empty properties, and there are properties that are in the process of being done up, and there are others where someone owns them but doesn't want to do anything with them. It's a sort of constantly flexing number, but we've got a big issue in Wiltshire. It's an issue in other parts of the country as well, but particularly in Wiltshire, given our military connection, where we have got about, give or take a couple, 1,350 empty MOD properties. They're outside the wire, so they're out in the community. They're spread all over the place, so there are concentrations in, as you'd expect, Lynham and Tidworth, but they're also in Salisbury and Amesbury, in Devizes and in some of the villages. They have been empty for a long time. We don't know how long. For example, the Devizes ones, it's at least 5 years, probably seven, talking to residents there. And in some areas, you've got sort of concentrations of several empty properties. In others, you've got some that are still in use with military families, some that are empty, and some that the MOD had then rented out to people. Because the MOD don't own the housing, they were all sold to a company called Annington Homes, I think in 1990, maybe 89, somewhere around then, and then leased back to the MOD. So the MOD pay rent on the properties, whether they're empty or not. They had then rented some of those out to private tenants. And this first came to light as an issue just after lockdown, or the first lockdown, when the MOD suddenly announced that they were evicting a number of those private tenants whatever notice. It was a comparatively short notice. When we went out to sort of engage and try and find out what was going on, it was apparent that they said they were evicting those tenants because they wanted to hand that housing back to Annington. There was under the terms of the deal, when the MOD stopped using housing, they can hand it back to Annington, who then sell it on the private market. But they were trying to evict people from properties when there were empty properties next door. It didn't make sense. Must have been maybe rather cross at the time. These were people who, in some cases, just moved in, many of whom were ex-forces. And so we had a look at it, found out quite how many empty properties there were, made it very clear that we would like, if they came on the market, we could look at buying them, bring them into the housing revenue account, our council housing stock. But also then, as we've had the refugee crises that have come along, the Afghan scheme and then the Ukraine scheme, we've asked whether the MOD would be able to help housing there, because there's a shortage of housing in Wiltshire. We don't quite have a housing crisis. We have a housing problem. And again, there's been no willingness from the MOD to help with any of that. They've come back to us with a spread of reasons, excuses. We've been told that the property is all being handed back to Annington to be sold. Well, none of it has been. That it's being repaired, that it's needed for urgent redeployment. You don't urgently redeploy families. Urgent deployments tend to be just the personnel, and this is family housing, or that it's needed for standard redeployments. But if you think that roughly speaking, 20% of MOD personnel live in that kind of housing, then if you've got 1,350, then if you sort of extrapolate what that means in terms of redeployment, you're looking at the ability to redeploy thousands, 10,000 or no, I could probably, my number's slightly wrong there, about 7,000 people. And I mean, that's a significant chunk of the army that's based in Wiltshire. The MOD know what its deployments are. At the moment, they're reducing numbers, not increasing them, although numbers in Wiltshire are probably going to increase slightly. So it just doesn't make sense.
So that's Richard Kluwer there, leader of Wiltshire Council, former army officer. Martin, he's making a lot of good points there, isn't he? And I think, in a way, it's like the military, they've got this rather arrogant attitude that because we're the military, you better not try and intimidate us because we've got tanks.
Well, I mean, it's it's certainly a bit of that. But also, I'm very suspicious of the role of this private company. I mean, what you know, if the Ministry of Defence owns all of these houses, why would you want to sell them to a private company? What for? If you could sell them to the local council for council housing, why not? But this insidious privatisation. Look at it's happening all over the place. Yeah. And land is big. Lots of public land has been sold off. It goes on year after year. Public land is sold off into the private sector with no kind of anybody looking at what's going on or who's getting the land or anything. We have a rentier economy in a technical term in this country, where those who own and speculate in land and financial services are being basically looting the rest of the population.
Well, there's a bit of a twist to the tale, because if you go back to Tuesday, the 15th of March this year in the Daily Telegraph, military homes row heads to court. Guy Hans files legal claim against the Ministry of Defence to block the renationalisation of the 7.6 billion housing portfolio. So what's been happening here is the Conservative government have looked at this whole deal and they've said, well, actually, we think this the privatisation was a bad idea. But Guy Hans' housing firm has launched a legal proceedings against the government to block the renationalisation of its portfolio of thousands of military homes. And it looks like maybe as if these homes in Wiltshire are just part of this kind of legal impasse. Hans' company, Annington Homes, has begun legal action in two courts after talks with the Ministry of Defence over the renationalisation broke down. Annington offered to contribute £150 million to maintain the homes, but was rebuffed by the MOD. He's now launched a judicial review as well as a High Court claim to challenge the MOD's plans. Defence chiefs are trying to use leasehold rights to reclaim homes that were first sold off by John Major's administration in 1996. So that seems to be what's going on here, Martin. The military have realised that Annington Homes and the private people are just a disaster as owners of these places, and they need to have them back, even though they were being told, well, if you privatise them, these company can run them so much more cheaply and efficiently than the ministry can. Well, the answer is no, they haven't. And also, they're now starting to look at them as their own private property that they can use to speculate with.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm glad that the government is deciding to renationalise these houses. But that you can see that the people who've got their hands on them now are determined to keep hold of them. And this has been this kind of creation of vested interest, by using public resources to give to private companies and individuals. This is what Thatcherism is all about.
Yeah, it is. I'll put a link up to the story.
That's in a nutshell. That's what it is.
I'll put a link up to this privatisation, the attempt to renationalise the homes, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. They've done quite a good job. Helen Carhill, another Carhill, up at the Daily Telegraph here, and she's looked at the way that the housing estate, and there's 57,400 homes which were privatised by Major. Hans apparently brokered the privatisation deal while he was head of the principal financial group at Nomura, whoever they are. He later purchased the properties through his private equity firm, Terra Firma. The portfolio is now valued at 7.6 billion. So I suppose you could call Guy Hans a UK oligarch, couldn't you? The MOD sold off these 57,400 homes for £1.7 billion back then, and they are now thought to be worth £7.6 billion.
That's our money. That money should be in the public domain to be used for public purposes. He's captured it. And that, of course, is the...
More than that, the government's government has since been criticised for failing to properly value the homes in the original auction, Martin.
Well, that's right, isn't it? If you sell public property for less than it's worth, and of course that's what happened in the privatisations of the gas industry. Remember Telsyd and all the rest of it? They were sold, and even the shares in the Royal Mail, If you're going to sell public property, you should sell it for what it's actually worth so that the public gets the full value of its previous investment. But to sell off public property for less than it's worth or to give it away in order to buy support, this is the story of Thatcherism. And it's the same true of the sale of council houses. If people had had to buy them what the value that the houses were actually worth, most of them couldn't have afforded to buy them. But they were allowed to buy them at much lower than the actual real price of the house. That's a free handout to those people, and a free handout which has turned into being millions of pounds for some of the people involved. Now, they're very happy, and many of them vote Conservative as a result. But that's our money, which right. should be used for other things.
Well, they have a picture of Guy Hans in this article in The Telegraph, and he's got this kind of weird blank face looking at the camera. Annington has argued that the scheme is not appropriate for use on a large number of homes. So that's what they're doing through the courts. So this is how they're trying to block it. The renationalisation, and also, of course, there will be questions about the original value. But the MOD just wants to get his hands back on this stock because it needs them. And Mr. Hans has embarked upon lengthy legal battles in the past. His ill-fated takeover of music group EMI sparked a legal dispute with Citigroup that lasted 7 years. Citigroup lent Terra Firma, this is his private equity firm, £2.5 billion to fund that deal. Mr. Hans later chased the bank through the courts in both New York and London over allegations of fraud, but he abandoned the £1.5 billion case in 2016. The MOD declined to comment. Well, maybe he's going to have to abandon this case too, Martin, and we can get our military homes back.
Well, it would be nice to see, but of course, you know, in the wider issue is that all sorts of public resources have been squandered and deliberately put into the hands of private operators who are basically fleecing us.
Well,
it's been going on for years.
Yeah, not least of which, of course, is the water companies. And we covered this a little briefly. I mean, I think I should be shouting this from the rooftops about the abstraction by the water firms. I interviewed Peter Berenius back in 1992, I think it was, in Salisbury, who was complaining about the levels of water in the chalk streams around Salisbury in Wiltshire, and saying that he'd been living there for 40 or 50 years and he'd never seen them so low over the past 5 years. Well, you do your maths, you go back to 1987. What was happening then? Well, the water boards were being privatised, and it's since the year that the water boards were privatised that the water levels had gone down. We discovered at the BBC in Salisbury that it was Wiltshire Sound, it was our Salisbury office, and I think the Salisbury Journal covered it too, that the private water companies had been abstracting massive amounts of water from boreholes from the aquifers that lie under the ground, which is where all the fresh water, because this is a lot cheaper for them to process. If they deal, Martin, the private water companies with reservoir water and other forms of groundwater, that is, you know, stuff just lying there from rivers, etc., on the surface, then that all has to be treated, and it's quite a pain and expensive for them to do so. But if they're sucking the water up from the aquifers, it's a lot cheaper. And as a result, what they've been doing is lowering water levels right across the country in a way they were never allowed to do when they were water boards. The idea was that these boreholes were sunk in case there were serious droughts, and that they were very carefully monitored, that the water companies had to ask permission, the boards, in order to take water. And now, of course, what we're getting is these stories like water scarcity. EU countries are forced to restrict drinking water access. Severe droughts and scarce rain have forced water restrictions in southern European countries. Climate change is making itself felt across the continent, says Deutsche Welle. Well, no, I would say privatisation is making itself felt here in Britain. As we go into a so-called drought, well, I mean, it is a drought. The idea is that we're looking around seeing these rivers being very, very low. The only thing is that the private water companies are doing something similar to the private firm was doing with the MOD homes. They're profiteering with them and they're taking the mickey.
They are. And also, of course, the pollution levels in our rivers has massively increased, because there was a very good long read in The Guardian last week. This retired police officer and scientist have been taking, you know, they've been carrying out research, and they show that in theory, water companies are allowed to ditch sewage into the water supply if there's too much rain. But they're supposed to notify every time they do it, and there's supposed to be a system of control. But what they've uncovered is that they routinely dump sewage into the water because they know nobody's ever going to tell them not to. And the motivation for private monopolies like the water companies is always to make profits for the shareholders rather than how important is water to the rest of the society.
Well, this
is why
you get
why you shouldn't privatise such
things. This is also why the Tories shouldn't do the bonfire of the regulation of all this stuff. We've also got...
Yes, if you're not going to own it yourself, you've got to regulate it. Yeah.
We've also got 600 million litres of drinking water being leaked every day by these companies.
That's because they haven't invested in upgrading their infrastructure.
So, I mean, it's not just renationalisation of the petrol diesel companies and the gas companies that we should be talking about. It's water too.
Well, water's an obvious one, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can't actually shop around for water. You've got to buy it from the person who sends the water to your tap. And of course, in Scotland, Scottish Water is owned by the Scottish government. And in Wales, the not-for-profit Welsh Water Board is not nationalised, but it's not run but as a private business. In England, we have got the glory of private water, which means we're going to have hosepipe bans and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, the shareholders... I mean, the Lib Dems have been saying what we should be doing is saying that the managers of these companies, until they fix what's going on, they shouldn't get any bonuses and all the rest of it. I mean, they should never have been in the private sector in the first place, but they've siphoned off billions of public money because they shouldn't be making any money out of it. But there they are making all of this money. And of course, they've ruined the infrastructure on which everything depends. That's why you don't privatise these things. But tell Margaret Thatcher. She didn't believe in that.
Final item.
Tell Rishi Sunak. He don't believe in it either.
Before the final item before the break is the drag queen story hour, just like the family sex show. This is a rather concerning tendency to sexualise children. I caught up with some of the people that have been going around to these protests, and I thought I'd ask them a bit about it. So this is the drag queen protesters. I first asked about this whole concept of sexualizing infants because they believe that's what's going on.
You've got 2% of the population in the UK that are at a young age and know, and there's absolutely no problem and they need supporting, but it's a minority and there's 5% worldwide. Now, I'm sure that most people have been through phases. I was a tomboy, complete tomboy when I was growing up. And I thank God that's in the 80s, because nowadays I'd have been pushed into, you know, well, maybe you need this counselling, then maybe we need to encourage you to, you know, think about change, that you're in the wrong body. I would never have thought that. And if that is what these 2% of the UK children feel, then let them go through that and let them find themselves naturally. Don't push anything. And also, don't confuse the other 98% of children who are innocent and don't feel this. Don't push it into them and make them doubt their gender and their sexuality either.
There's a 4,000 right since this new sex education has come in Scotland. There's been a 4,000 rise with young children confused about their gender.
4,000%
rise. 4,000% rise. Thinking they are not what they were born as. The new sex education, which is coming into Wales, into effect in September, actually, the people of Wales didn't want it. They voted and they didn't want it. Nevertheless, our politicians went ahead with it. This includes teaching sex from the age of 3, and in Wales there's no opt-out. Also at 5, you get to choose a gender. And in the Rhondda, there was a case earlier on this year because they were trialing it. It's a trans pack, it's called, for schools. And basically, the parent didn't realise for 2 weeks that his little boy was dressing in a dress. As soon as he got into school, they pushed the ideology onto him that child had to dress in a dress without telling the parent. But thank God that PCP Wales in Wales, the girls who have been campaigning against this for the last 2 years, have actually got a High Court case going into Cardiff because the High Court judge agreed the case needs to be answered, and PCP Wales are actually taking the Welsh government to court, and they're the first country out of the 52 this sex education was rolled out. They are actually fighting back. The Welsh people are actually fighting back for this because it shouldn't be allowed. And as far as libraries are concerned, it's exactly the same ideology. He's there. If you see pictures of him, they are disgraceful. He's actually dressed in a onesuit. He's obviously not wearing pants. And if you know what I mean by not wearing pants in a jumpsuit, right, in a drag queen, everything is showing. It's simple as that. And he's there with from 6 months up to, say, I think the age limit in Wales to go to these events for kids is 10.
So that's Casey speaking there, and Alex over in Wales, and they've been going to many of these events, just doing peaceful protests at them. Martin, it does seem that there is this kind of attempt to get kids before they even get to puberty to choose their sex, and then if they decide that they are the opposite sex, and then they're maybe going to get some puberty blockers. Is this something very strange? It's quite nice, I think, in a way, that Casey herself has fessed up there and said, well, when I was a young girl, I actually was a bit of a tomboy, but when it actually came to puberty, I grew up a bit.
Well, I think you shouldn't be assigning genders to children. I mean, when they are older, they can decide if they wish to be anything they want. But you shouldn't be, you know, when they are younger, they've got to be allowed to just be who they are. And that may involve boys wearing dresses and girls climbing trees.
Well, I mean, yeah, but the argument,
implication being following from that.
Look, the argument here is it's too late by then. And actually, a child of, say, 8 or 9, they can use a puberty blocker, and they can actually wait until a certain period of time, and then they can decide which sex they're going to be. Although, of course, it seems as if this is an attempt to allow people to choose their sex. And actually, surely this is just something that people cannot do. Ultimately, you can't choose your sex, and it's almost forcing people into a position where they're trying to do something which is impossible.
Well, some people, and they're very, very rare, are hermaphrodites. They have been born that way. That's clearly the case, but there's a very, very small number of them. Most people do have a clear gender when they're born, and you shouldn't be able to just change it on a whim, in my view. I know that some people think that you should. I don't think you can. I think it's perfectly okay for people to be trans and to dress in any way they please, and if they wish, to take drugs to change their hormonal balance, if they are adults and consenting. But you can't be forcing this on small children. Small children don't know most of what they're going to be when they grow up. They have to play around and work it out for themselves without being given, oh, you've got to choose between this and this. When, you know, when you're young, you want to be able to do whatever you want to do, and you need to explore with what you're doing. I mean, I was working in a school some years ago now, and this boy wanted to wear a dress, and one of the helpers, like a dinner lady, was saying, oh, you don't want to put that dress on. No, don't do that. And I just thought, no, let him, if he wants to put a dress on, let him put it on. What's the problem? You know, that's what dressing up's about. It's about dressing up. It doesn't mean he's going to be a girl, though. It's a boy wearing a dress. That's what's happening here. And of course, you know, children need to be allowed to play as they wish without people telling them what they've got to do. It's not right. They need to be allowed to just choose by playing. And that's, you know, I there's too much of an agenda here. And the more fundamental point about women's spaces is very clear, because the purpose for having women only spaces is because they are an oppressed group. They need to be able to gather in women only spaces so that they can talk about that. It's like if I said I can identify with the struggles of black people in Britain, but I can't say I'm black because I ain't. And it would be, you know, it would be wrong of me to go to an all black group to discuss problems of blackness if I was white. It wouldn't be allowed, would it? And the same is true of this. I mean, transgender men, because that's what we're talking about here, do not have an automatic right to women's spaces. And this is a logic which was developed initially by the Jewish Socialist Bund in Poland, Lithuania, where they were told that they got to join the Polish Socialist Party. They said, no, we are Jews and we're oppressed as Jews. So we need to be able to meet as Jews and set ourselves separate. Well, they spoke a separate language, Yiddish. So they didn't even speak the same language as the Poles. And the same thing happened in America in the 1960s. Blacks demanded their own spaces, because it's all very well that if whites come into our spaces, they tend to take over and tell us what to do.
Well, I mean,
we need to have our own space defended.
I think we should do some sort of satirical comedy show, because you've just put into the mind the idea of you dressing up as a black and white minstrel and going to an anti-racism meeting organised by black people. I mean, it would be really just taking the mickey.
If you turned up at an anti-racist, a Black Lives Matter, please only black, you don't want people to spend all of their time in separate groups. But the right to have a separate group if you're oppressed, like gay people might say, I don't want straight people coming to my gay group. You know, it's quite straightforward. And the transsexual issue causes much confusion and difficulty on the progressive left. And I think that is its purpose. It's weaponization of, you know, they're trying to turn people against each other, the people behind this kind of thing, because there used to be quite a strong consensus about these things. But you can see that now the gay rights movement and the feminist movement are starting to drift apart. But, you know, people don't necessarily have to agree about everything. That's also part of politics.
Yeah, and the protests go on. And our final clip from the Drag Queen Story Hour family sex show protesters, Casey and Phil, is where they look at this organisation. It's called PCP, which stands for Wales Public Child Protection.
He's getting paid £150 per library and he does three a day. So he's getting paid £450 from the council, which is council tax payers' money. And we haven't been asked. And what's the librarian's job? I mean, surely that's her job. And plus they've got all the security, extra security. They double up and all the police. And again, that's coming from our pockets and we're paying for it. A lot. Also, the locals, every place I've been to, the locals haven't even known what's going on in the library. And where we've just been today, they've said that their library's been telling them for ages they've got no money for extra books.
So if you can just introduce yourself, Phil. This is, I mean, a kind of theatrical thing. That's what they say. It's entertainment for the kids, which a librarian can't do.
Well, I'm Phil. I've been an activist for about 4 to 5 years. Also, I cover all injustices, veterans, for the children. I did it all the COVID. I film them. I'm Real News, Live News. And basically, we have a safeguarding issue, and the safeguarding issue is back in 2020, this ADHD actually had a safeguarding issue against him. The Lorinda Trust, who employed him for an event, they decided it was a safeguarding issue because it is social media. Now, he's taken quite a lot of that down now at the moment. And also the Daily Mail done an article on him not long ago. He is a safeguarding issue and he should never be telling stories or trying to push his books onto children.
Yeah, Ada HD is the name of the person. And I'll put the full interview with those two up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you're interested. They talk a bit about, you know, whereabouts these protests are taking place, why they do what they do. And it's interesting, I think, that Phil particularly has come from quite a long video activist tradition now. I mean, going back a few years. His channel is called Real News, Live News, and he goes to these events and he does live Facebook streams, live YouTube video streams, so that anyone can kind of see what's going on literally in real time, because of course Martin, the TV are not really covering these issues as they should be.
Well, there are a number of issues here, aren't there? I mean, we've tried to explore some of them. As things stand, I'd be surprised if anybody turns up to these events. Does anybody actually go with their children to these events? And well, if they don't,
yes, they do. The yeah, they do. Usually a few, not a lot. But then the other thing, of course, is what you've got is the anti-fascists turning up, accusing the protesters of being themselves fascists. So,
well, but yes, we had a face-off, as you know, in Bristol about this the other week. Well, it's not illegal for, I mean, you could say it's a waste of money, especially if enough people don't turn up and all the rest of it. But it's, as things stand, it is not illegal to do these things. So if you want to protest about it, you've got to recognise that they've got a legal right, unless the law is changed, to have these events. But, I mean, safeguarding issues are very pertinent. I mean, you know, I work with children. There's an awful lot of pressure, you know, that you've got to fulfil all of these criteria before you can have access to children. And, you know, that is sadly a necessary thing.
Phil from Real News, Knife News then, he mentioned a safeguarding issue in the Daily, the Daily Mail revealed back a couple of weeks ago, 20th of July, that the drag queen was banned by London's National Theatre after joking that children should be taught to open their legs during an X-rated act in front of disgusted mothers and babies. A parent condemned the comments made at the drag show as inappropriate, made by a drag queen known as Sharon Legrand. A River Stage festival was described as having activities for the whole family. The National Theatre has said the act will not be performing at future events.
Obviously, if you've got safeguarding issues with an individual person, that is the issue with that person. It's not a question of are they a drag queen or not a drag queen. They've got an issue with safeguarding issues. So that's clear. But of course, that's not the same person as the one the other two were talking about. It might be interesting to hear then a justification from these people that want to see drag queens reading stories to young children. Let's see what would they say.
Or of course, the drag queens themselves. I'll have a go at doing that over the next week or so. But that's it for the first part. So we'll be back after the break to hear from Scott Ritter about the inside info about the slow collapse of the lies about Ukraine.
O God, from whom all holy desires, all good counsels, and all just works do proceed, give unto thy servants that peace which the world cannot give, that both our hearts may be set to obey thy commandments, and also that by thee, we being defended from the fear of our enemies, may pass our time in rest and quietness, through the merits of Jesus Christ our Saviour. Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy defend us from all perils and dangers of this night, for the love of thy only Son, our Saviour, Jesus Christ.
The anthem is Celia McDowell's joyful setting of the 98th Psalm, in which God is praised for his saving power. O sing unto the Lord a new song, for he hath done marvellous things. His right hand and his holy arm hath gotten him the victory.
Oh,
Well, that's Sharf Benjamin and Amanda from 1996, Jar Putting on the Pressure. Before that, Martin's favourite place of worship, Eton College, actually, which was on Radio 3 earlier this week, Wednesday afternoon, at Choral Evensong, and a rendition of the 98th Psalm. Anyhow, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with our Republican, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The talkradio.co.uk is our stream, which you can go direct to the stream. And of course, the show page is at thisweek.org.uk, where later tonight I'll be putting up the longer clips of various interviews that we've been hearing so far. For example, a longer one with the chap from, whose name escapes me now, from Wiltshire Council, talking about these empty homes and not really talking much about the privatisation, because that's something which I only figured out afterwards, and that was nothing about that in the ITV report. And obviously with Simon Baddeley as well, the stepson of famous Jack Hargreaves from Out of Town fame, someone who used to, he was actually a city lad really, but he had an absolute love of the countryside and a very good understanding of it and a fantastic way of coming across. I think we're going to start straight off by just having a listen to Scott Ritter, Martin. I mean, Scott really has been a shining beacon of light in this whole Ukraine world, because I find it incredible. What we're about to hear is the total opposite of everything that the entire multi-tens of billions of pounds of every year of London media in terms of magazines, books, broadcasting, newspapers is churning out, the total opposite of what we're about to hear. Why is that?
Well, it's not just the London media, it's the Western media in general. It's because they've become an arm of the deep state, which is, you know, it's a corporate military industrial complex state. And
I mean, at the heart of it, surely this is a financial organization, a kind of financial Fourth Reich.
Well, it's the financial people are the ultimate string pullers, obviously, but they make their money by selling weaponry and so on. So it's a global power elite, if you like, that's behind all of this. And if you think about it, the demonization of Russia has been going on ever since Putin came to power. At first, they thought that they could manipulate him, and therefore they were relatively agnostic about him. But they've things like the Skripal affair and so on. To my mind, there's no doubt that that was carried out by Western, you know, MI6.
Yeah, hang on, that was only 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, they weren't being so mean to Putin in the noughties, were they?
Well, no. The big turning point was the 2007 Munich Security Conference speech, where he just basically read them the riot act and said, you know, you can't just talk to us like that and you're going to have to reconsider. And of course, they then perceived him as an enemy and all the rest of it. But they've worked very hard to make Russia an enemy. Operation Beluga, we know the name of the operation, like Operation Gladio, because Paul Burrell, the top French anti-terrorist police officer, he was in Berezovsky's security detail. Berezovsky, of course, the coroner said that he didn't commit suicide in Surrey, and he was Putin's political opponent. But they didn't go on about that because, in actual fact, his daughter thinks he was murdered by MI6.
So what did Putin say? The Munich Security Conference quite clearly is very, very important. It was used as a springboard for Zelensky this year to call for the Western powers to help Ukraine get nuclear weapons. I mean, that back in 2007, what was Putin saying then?
Well, basically, he was saying you've got to change your attitude towards Russia. You know, we want to cooperate with you, but you can't just tell us what to do. And they weren't having it. And that's from that then on, it was clear that they were determined to try and get regime change in Russia.
Anyway, I find it fascinating. You know, your analysis fits in perfectly with our clip we're about to hear from Scott Ritter, where he explains about arms and aid to Ukraine going missing. Because what we've seen, haven't we, is a kind of, well, we've been witnessing it in the MOD story there, for example, a financial oligarchy in the West with their fingers in the till. And of course, this is the norm in Ukraine, as Scott Ritter explains, as he tells us about arms and aid to Ukraine going missing, the story we covered last week.
I've heard the reports and I am convinced they're true. I'm also convinced that, you know, the U.S. government is complicit in this. Why would I say that? Well, the $40 billion supplemental defense acquisition bill that was passed by the U.S. Congress in May of this year, one senator rose up in opposition. He wasn't opposed to giving Ukraine the aid, but what he wanted was the imposition of an inspector general who would oversee how this stuff was being utilized. Where did it get to whom it was supposed to? How were they spending the money? Was it being spent on what Congress wanted? What was happening to it? Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, and McConnell, the Minority Leader, both came together with the support of their parties in opposition. So basically, the United States said, no, we're giving this money to Ukraine, and we're not going to require Ukraine to tell us anything about how it's spent, where it's going. One of the reasons why this happens is that the United States government knows how Ukraine works. It is one of the most corrupt governments in the world, the most corrupt government in Europe today. And it only works through bribes. It only works, through this corruption. So we can't, if we tried to impose a system of accountability on the Ukrainians, they would cease to function because they don't know how to behave responsibly. Their entire system is about corruption, about bribery, about theft. And that's just how it works. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the vast majority of the money that we're sending the Ukrainians is not going to whom it's supposed to go, but rather lining the pockets of the power brokers who then decide how they're going to dole it out, how much they're going to keep for themselves, et cetera. The light weaponry, like the NLAWs, the Javelins and the Stingers, this stuff's being sold on the black market. We know this. It's out there. We see it. The United States has sent a drone called the Switchblade, which gets shot up in the air and then it hovers over the battlefield until it can be told to pick a target or somebody can pick a target for it. And then it'll go in and blow it up. They're selling that now for $4,000. What we're doing is, A, depriving Ukrainians at the front lines of weapons that they would need to have an adequate defense. And B, we're empowering criminal groups and terrorist groups in Europe and around the world with weapons they otherwise wouldn't have. And one of these days, there will be blowback. A javelin will be used against a politician's armored car and the politician will die. A Stinger will be used to shoot down an airliner with hundreds of innocent civilians on it. And a Switchblade drone will be used to assassinate somebody. I mean, this is what's happening here. And shame on the United States, because we could have, we've been selling weapons to people for a long time. We know how to do it. We know how to account for these weapons. And it's very easy to put a tracking device on these weapons so that they can be accounted for. That's how we do it. You go into a warehouse, you come in with your reader, you scan each weapon. You now know that all weapons are accounted for. When a weapon's expended in combat, a form is filled out, and that says this is how the weapon was disposed of. If a weapon malfunctions, need to be repaired. Again, scanned, shipped off, we know where that weapon is. It's not hard. We do it all the time. Don't do it in Ukraine, because Ukraine is, again, the most corrupt place in Europe, and it can't function with the kind of norms and standards that the rest of Europe and the rest of the world is accustomed to.
Well, I noticed that it was a Ukraine. I was quite surprised to see this, Scott. Al Jazeera and other people reported back on the 17th of July, a Ukrainian cargo plane carrying weapons crashed in Greece. Well, it didn't seem to be heading towards Ukraine. No, it was heading away en route from Serbia to Bangladesh.
Yeah, I mean, but what I understand is that that cargo plane was actually, even though it was flagged to Ukraine, it was a contract aircraft, and that the weapons on board may not have been Ukrainian, probably Serbian. So there's something about that it's still part of the dark market for weapon sales. But I actually think on this one, the Ukrainians get a pass, not because they're innocent, just because they weren't involved in that particular scam.
Well, Scott Ritter there, the former UN's weapons inspector. The full interview will be up on our show page tonight. Absolutely riveting 50 minutes from one of the real experts on the whole situation in Ukraine. Of course, he's being proved right, Martin, isn't he? These crooked, corrupt Ukrainians would rather take the gifts that the West and NATO are giving to them, sell them on the open on the black market, and make a few bob that way, and then basically cut and run. And as Scott is also pointing out, this is a great for international terrorist groups and international arms dealers. The sort of organised crime international mafia are laughing and they're rubbing their hands. They're having a field day.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ukraine, when people talk about Russia as a mafia state, Ukraine really is a mafia state. You know, the oligarchs run it. And, you know, to give the you know, it's there will be kickbacks going to Westerners as well, as we saw in the Burisma affair.
And, of course, all these weapons that are heading off there, these massive amounts of money are going to these weapons companies. Let's never, ever talk about Russian oligarchs without talking about Viktor Pinchuk, who we hardly hear anything of. He's a major figure at the World Economic Forum, sponsoring all these various meetings. And he seems to be one of the main instigators of this mafia state they're trying to impose on Eastern Europe now.
Well, it's always been a den of corruption, Ukraine. But it was there was a kind of modus vivendi between the two main population groups, the Ruthenian speaking Westerners and the Russian speaking Easterners. They, you know, there was a kind of recognition that the interests of both groups would have to be accommodated. But the West has inflamed this to the point, you know, they've encouraged the West Ukrainians to take a hostile attitude towards the Russian Ukrainians.
Yeah, you know what? I mean,
the state as a result is in meltdown.
Well, it might sound a little bit conspiratorial to talk about it in these terms, but Viktor Pinchuk is, certainly as I see it, a kind of parallel government leader in that part of the world. He's a dual Ukrainian-Israeli citizen. I can remember reading these writings years ago, published by John Robison, the Secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh, leaked from the original foundation of the Illuminati from Adam Weishaupt, where they talked about having a map of Europe with their own parallel governments and their own parallel systems in each one. And Viktor Pinchuk, as the master of the main Masonic lodge in Kyiv, he was the guy who was telling the riot police what to do and basically managing the coup for the CIA back in 2014.
Well, he's one figure. And of course, you've got Poroshenko, the chocolate king. He's another figure.
My point, though, is that these people who are more public, because Kolomoisky, for example, isn't that public. You know, we talk about him on our program, but very few. Mentioned.
Kolomoisky is in Israel at the moment because the Zelensky government have fallen out with him. Zelensky was basically his protege. But Kolomoisky was saying, you know, about 18 months ago, we're going to have to negotiate with the Russians, which is also what Zelensky was saying. But what's prevented negotiations is the Americans and the British particularly. Britain has played a particularly pernicious role in this crisis because they've encouraged the more extreme elements on the Ukrainian side to just say that we're not negotiating about anything. And that, of course, is why we're in the mess we're in. This should have been settled through negotiation. It could have been settled at the beginning of this crisis through negotiation, because the Ukrainians, for the first time in 8 years, were actually talking to the Russians once the special military operation had begun. And there was a meeting in Istanbul where it looks as if they cleared it all up and they knew what they were going to do. And then Boris Johnson arrived in Kyiv and told Zelensky, no, it's all off. We're not negotiating anything. We're going to fight to the end.
Well, which is why
he will be the end, because the Ukrainians are going to lose.
Well, that's the sort of thing which he might have been earning his spurs for becoming the Secretary General of NATO, isn't it?
And
we've also seen Zelensky's star falling, which was a fascinating section. I mean, I've only had a chance to put out a few clips from the interview with Scott Ritter, but he talks about that extensively and what's happened in the various tugs of war going on within Ukraine, outside Ukraine, which means that Zelensky is basically finding himself increasingly isolated. He'll probably go at some point and hop in his private jet and head off to live out his retirement in the Florida Keys somewhere, or with one of his yachts and his nice private house over there. But anyway, I also asked Scott about this whole business of Amnesty reports of human the Ukrainian army using human shields in cities that they're defending, actually using, not shipping out the civilian population before using a city as a gigantic fortress, which is absolutely horrific. Because I noticed quite a lot of people out there have been saying, oh, well, this always happens. Anyway, Scott knows the score. He knows the way the Americans make war. And very much like you, Martin, he thinks the Russians are a rather enormous contrast with them. So here's Scott talking about this use of the Amnesty report last week, criticizing the Ukrainian army for using people as human shields, the civilian population.
Well, first of all, we know the Russians are reluctant to attack because the Russian Ministry of Defense on a daily basis releases a list of these targets, saying that in this town, the school has been occupied by this unit, boom, boom, boom. And then the Russians do not attack that location. So the Russians are calling the Ukrainians out on this, and they aren't attacking it, especially when they know that the Ukrainians, because it's not just, here's the deal. If let's say I'm defending the city of Albany, I'm allowed to defend the city of Albany. What I'm not allowed to do is hold the population of Albany hostage. I can't use them as human shield. So what any normal law-abiding nation would do is evacuate the civilian population of Albany and turn it into a fortress city. And in doing so, schools, hospitals, and all other formerly protected sites no longer have that protection because they're going to be turned into military defense locations. That's normal. When people say that's what happens in wartime, it's normal. They're right. As long as a building is not being used for its purposes, like a school isn't being used for a school or a hospital is not being used for a hospital, and instead you put military equipment there, it's a military target. It's fair game. What's happening here, though, is that the Ukrainians are, they're occupying buildings and they're keeping the civilians there as human shields. And this is what Amnesty is calling them out for. This is what the Washington Post called them out for earlier. And one of the reasons why they're doing this is that there's overwhelming evidence coming from the Ukrainian people themselves. You have mothers going up to Ukraine saying, get your tank out of here. You're near my home. My children live here. If you have your tank here, the Russians are going to attack you and you're going to endanger my family. This is happening over and over and over again. We talked about the casualties earlier, approximately 250,000 Ukrainian casualties. I would say that the Russians have probably suffered somewhere in the region of 50,000 casualties, dead and wounded. That's 300,000 joint casualties. Normally in large scale ground combat like this, it takes place in urban environment or heavily populated environment. You get a 1-to-1 casualty ratio between the civilians and the military. And here we have a situation where the Ukrainians are documented as using their own population as human shield. But here's the amazing fact. About 8,000 to 10,000 Ukrainian civilians have died. That's a lot. That's sad. But you know what? The civilian to military casualty ratio is historically low, historically low. And when you have dead civilians, it's primarily because the Ukrainian army has used the civilians as human shields. The fact that this casualty level is so low is proof positive of the kind of campaign that the Russians are running. This is not the indiscriminate use of firepower that the West is talking about. This is the most disciplined application of combat power in modern history. Because, again, how can I say that? Look at the ratio of dead civilians, dead combatants. It is historically low. Historically low. If the United States was running this campaign, based upon what we did to Mosul, what we did to Raqqa, what we've done to Fallujah, you could expect hundreds of thousands of dead civilians, because that's how we roll. The Russians are rolling differently. They're being very disciplined in their fire. That's one of the reasons why their rates of advance are so slow, because they're being assiduous. They know when the Ukrainians are dug in to civilian areas, and they're avoiding heavy combat in that area until which time the civilians are evacuated, when in reality they had every right to attack that place and kill civilians. International humanitarian law is quite clear that when a combatant power digs into a civilian facility, it loses protection. It loses protection. Therefore, let's say the Ukrainians dig into a hospital that's functioning. That hospital is no longer protected. The Russians have every legal right to attack it, but they're not. They're not. And I wish Amnesty International would tell the rest of the story. It's great that they call out the Ukrainians for what they're doing. But you know what? The Russians need to get full credit for how they're pursuing this conflict.
Well, he's giving the Russians a pat on the back there, Martin, saying that actually what they're doing is incredibly responsible, and they're and particularly when it comes to these civilian targets.
Well, I think that's accurate, and it's a war, and there's people being killed. It's very sad. It is tragic beyond belief, really. But at the same time, the Russians are pursuing their objectives quite cautiously, because in any case, they're trying to create new Russian speaking states in land which is currently, supposedly Ukrainian. And they intend to rebuild this region. So that's why they're being very cautious about smashing it up and killing people who are there, because they're fighting for hearts and minds. There was a James Meek, who's written in the London Review of Books. He's reporting from Nikolaev, because there's it's very pro-Ukrainian article. But even he is saying that the locals are saying, well, the real problem is not the Russians, it's the Ukrainians bringing their military. You know, they scatter them around all over the place, and the Russians are going to they're risking our lives.
I mean,
don't forget, many of the civilians in this region are Russian speakers.
Yeah, we
voted 80% to secede from the Ukraine in 2014. They're still occupied by the Ukrainians.
That's right. The casualty figures he gives there, I think, are fascinating. So roughly 5 Ukrainian soldiers are casualties against every 1 Russian. So it's not a 5-to-1 casualty rate, which is...
The interesting thing is the civilian casualty rate is so low.
Well, that's 50-1.
Civilian casualty rate is often 80%.
I know. I've been crunching the figures. He's saying it can be as much as 1-to-1 in a normal situation. He's saying that actually what the Russians are doing is 50 times better than that. 50-to-1. So that for every single soldier that's being killed, for every 50 soldiers are being killed, only 1 civilian is being killed, which is actually incredible. Which is why he's saying... basically giving them a pat on the back, and I think we should too, for making sure that
the other thing about this, of course, is that the Russians, they're trying to preserve their own people and not have heavy casualties, but they've also they've made a decision, executive decision, if we have to take more casualties of our military in order to preserve civilian lives, then that's what we will do. Totally different from the US way of war.
The US way of war is we don't want our guys to die because
otherwise the population back home might stop supporting the war. When in doubt, save the lives of your own personnel rather than civilians.
Let's revisit this 5-to-1 figure, because in urban warfare, this is extraordinary. I mean, it could potentially be something like the other way around. So the defenders
in many conflicts around the world, the military casualties to civilian casualties are 20% military, 80% civilian.
Martin, we're not talking about the military to civilians. We're talking about the defenders against the attackers' casualties. So the defenders, in this case, the Ukrainian army, are losing 5 soldiers for every 1 the attackers, the Russians, are losing, which is extraordinary. In any kind of urban combat situation, you'd normally expect the figure potentially to be the other way around.
Well, you would, except that the Russians are not fighting as they're expected to do. They should have looked at what they did in Syria, and they'd have perhaps understood better the way the Russians approach these things.
Yeah.
They've had a much better war in Syria than Britain had in Helmand province or in Basra in many other places where we just got cuffed out by the local boys.
That's not happening to the Russians. Anyway, another thing I talked to, it was really quite difficult to pick clips out from Scott. And like I say, if you want to hear him talk about the slow fall over the last few weeks of the star of Zelensky, That's in the longer version, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I mean, I put it to Scott that actually that Russia invaded Ukraine, and he put me straight on that one. Hang on, Scott, because they Russians invaded the Donbass, if you don't remember, which is part of Ukraine, not the other way around.
No, let me correct you. Ukraine initiated genocide against ethnic Russians in 2014. That is a statement of fact. The Azov Regiment, Aidar, Kraken, the Nazis rolled into the Donbass, took over Mariupol, brutally raped and murdered ethnic Russians. And you're going to tell me Russia invaded Ukraine? No. What Russia did is provide support to the ethnic Russians in Ukraine to save their lives. And it became a civil conflict. Russia, throughout this period of time, from 2014 to 2022, respected the territorial integrity of Ukraine. They refused to recognize the independence of the Donbass. Even when the citizens, the Russian ethnic Russians, said, we want our independence, we want to be part of Russia, Vladimir Putin and the Russian government said, no, you are part of Ukraine. What we will fight for is to have the Ukrainian government give you autonomy, respect your language, your culture. Because remember, these neo-Nazis working in Kiev banned the Russian language, banned Russian culture, banned being Russian. They call them orcs. They treat them as subhumans. This is all this documented fact. And the Russians said, we'll fight to protect your rights, but you are part of Ukraine. In 2015, the European, France and Germany formed something called the Normandy Format Forum. And they worked with the Ukrainians and the Russians to come up with what's called the Minsk Accords. Ukraine agreed to implement this. What was required is for Ukraine to take the Minsk Accords to the parliament and get it ratified so that these new laws would be passed. And then we'd have peace. Peace would break out. The Donbass would be Ukraine. The ethnic Russians would have their rights protected. Ukrainian government never ratified it. Why? We now know. Poroshenko, the president before Zelensky, has admitted that the Minsk Accords was a sham from the start. A sham. The sole purpose of the Minsk Accords was to buy time so that NATO could train the Ukrainian army so that the Ukrainian army could forcefully conquer the Donbass. And NATO did that from 2015 to 2022. NATO was training battalion every 55 days. That's 40 battalions that were trained, equipped, and organized by NATO, sent east for the sole purpose of killing Russians. And we also now know that the Ukrainians took this army, 60,000 of them, and massed them in eastern Ukraine, preparing to carry out their own offensive against the Donbass starting in March of 2022. What the Russians did is, in accordance with Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, implemented what's known as collective preemptive self-defense. You say, that's very, that's weird. That's like word spaghetti. What are you doing, Ritter? I'm using the same language that NATO used to justify their military intervention in Kosovo in 1999. Russia didn't invent this. They just perfected it. And then so Russia carried out a preventive, a preemptive military attack to prevent Ukraine from moving on the Donbass. Russia didn't invade Ukraine. Russia carried out a special military operation. I'm not playing games here. An invasion is war. And if Russia went to war against Ukraine, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, because Ukraine would be wiped off the face of the earth. Russia carried out a special military operation to prevent Ukraine from launching a military assault on the Donbass. Remember, before Russia invaded or carried out the special military operation, they recognized the independence of both the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic. And they did not want to do for 8 years, but they were compelled to do it because it became apparent that Ukraine was never going to implement the Minsk Accords and that NATO was never going to be a good faith partner in this, that instead NATO was seeking to have Ukraine join NATO and take this 260,000 man army that NATO trained and use it aggressively against ethnic Russians. So no, I take great umbrage at the notion that Russia invaded Ukraine. They did no such thing.
well, a pretty good 4.5 minute summary. And I put in my place by Scott Martin, wasn't I?
Yes. I mean, in the West, the presentation of this conflict has been absolutely skewed. So it's always unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. When Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen, we could have had a UN Security Council resolution, and maybe we should have got a posse together to stop them and kick them out of Yemen. And we should have done it when they invaded Bahrain. They crossed an international border there. They invaded another country. But there's no sanctions on Saudi Arabia, is there? And that's because our military are embedded with the Saudi military, helping them to invade the Yemen. And of course, Yemen is, we're not talking about Yemen, we're talking about Ukraine, but the situation in Yemen is every bit as horrible as in the Ukraine. But yeah, we're doing the killing there. We're the bad guys, so we don't want to talk about that.
Would it be nice if Nancy Pelosi had bothered to go to Yemen? But of course, that doesn't fit in very well with their war agenda. You know, this world domination, same old dream.
Yes.
That was from Dr. No in 1962. Anyway, Martin, it's quiz time now for you. I'd like to, because I asked Scott this question before we hear his answer, I'd love to know what you think potential for nuclear war. I mean, you're always talking about this, and I think you're quite right to say that this is actually far more of a danger than climate, for example. And I asked Scott what he thought about that potential in Europe. What do you think in Europe or other parts of the world? Where is the most likely potential flashpoint?
Well, the obvious potential flashpoint is what we've just been talking about, the Ukraine, because NATO personnel are inside the Ukraine, including British military personnel, I'm certain of it, and they are killing Russians. So at some point, the Russians may conclude that, you know, we're at war with NATO, and then they'll start killing NATO personnel. Now, what will happen then is NATO will probably disintegrate, actually. But if it didn't disintegrate, the only answer NATO has got to that is to go nuclear. And don't forget, from Fairford, not far from Bristol, B-52 bombers, nuclear armed B-52 bombers, flew along the whole Russian border, about a year ago. And I showed you the video of the Russian pilots setting off a pressure wave inside the B-52. That sort of confrontation can go nuclear in a second. If there's a missile flying towards Russia, even if it's a conventional missile, they've got to presume it's got a nuclear warhead.
I mean, if we go back to the Cuban missile crisis, Curtis Lee May and General Power, I can't remember his first name. Anyway, they were complete lunatics at Strategic Air Command that seemed to have the idea that it was a great idea to start a nuclear war with the Soviet Union because they would win ultimately with no more than what they called expectable tens of millions of civilian casualties.
Well, that's right. And they haven't really changed their spots. They're still in the same mental space.
Anyway, so looking at nuclear war, let's hear from Scott Ritter as to where he thinks the real potential flashpoints are, because we just recently had the whole business of Kaliningrad, Martin, didn't we? Do you remember we reported on that? Maybe it was a bit naughty because the European Union stepped in apparently and said to the Latvians or the Lithuanians that they had to allow transshipment of goods between Russia and Kaliningrad, and that they couldn't just block them off because that could potentially spark a war. And so the Lithuanians were put in their place by the EU, thank God. But anyway, here's what Scott has got to say about the most interesting, dangerous potential flashpoints for nuclear war, having written a book called The Scorpion King, all about nuclear weapons.
There's a number of scenarios in Europe. I talked about Lithuania. There's the Poland moving into Western Ukraine scenario. There's Moldova moving against Transnistria. There's a number of things outside of the Ukrainian conflict itself that could lead to a NATO-Russian conflict that could manifest itself in a nuclear conflict. I think, however, all parties are aware of the dangers and are guarding against that kind of inadvertent trigger. I don't believe Europe is going to fall down the rabbit hole of pursuing direct conflict between NATO and Russia that could turn nuclear. My big fear is in the Pacific. because here China is dead serious about Taiwan. I mean, they just literally blockaded Taiwan for a week using military exercises that were a de facto training for an invasion of Taiwan. They flexed their muscles very strong, and they said, you know, that they will continue these exercises and that they're prepared to take military action if Taiwan seeks to be independent or if other nations treat Taiwan as independent. One of the things that happened during these exercises is that China said that the Taiwan Strait that separates mainland China from Taiwan, because China has a policy of one China, that it's not international waters, that it's purely the territorial waters of China, and nobody has a right to transit through that. So the United States and its eternal genius is going to challenge China by sailing American warships through the Taiwan Strait. Now, China is not going to sink the ship, I don't believe. I do think that China is going to say, once the ships go through, that's enough. You guys don't respect our territorial integrity. We're taking Taiwan off the map. Now what? President Biden has committed that the United States will defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. How is he going to defend? With what? The only thing we have is a fleet. And the closer the fleet gets to Taiwan, the more certainty is that that fleet will be sunk. These ships are extraordinarily vulnerable to Chinese missiles with hypersonic warheads. We don't have any defense against them. But what happens when China sinks five ships killing 15,000 Americans in one instant swoop? The United States will be compelled to seek retaliation for face-saving means, you know, only. That means that we will probably launch a low-yield nuclear weapon against a Chinese military facility, probably on the island of Hainan. There's a naval base there that that we think we can take out without significant civilian collateral damage. So we'll nuke China under the belief that by escalating, we then force China to de-escalate. What do you think China is going to do? Accept one of their cities, one of their naval facilities being nuked? No, they'll retaliate by nuking an American place, maybe the island of Guam. Will we accept that? Nope. Then we're going to nuke Shanghai. Then they're going to nuke Los Angeles. And then it's all she wrote. This is the biggest danger. Nuclear war in the Pacific, because the United States is engaged in irresponsible policies that we can't back up. I mean, I gave a speech in June in Houston, Texas, and the thematic of the speech was sort of stolen from Top Gun, but it was that Joe Biden's writing checks with his mouth that the American body can't cash, committing to the defense of Taiwan when we neither have a military plan to do so, nor the forces allocated to do so, nor the means to actually implement it. Is the height of hubris and ignorance. It's a very dangerous situation.
That's the final clip from Scott Ritter. Lots more he was sharing with me. And you might think, well, why didn't you use this, Tony? Because this is also fascinating. It's just, you know, he's one of the top people, a great authority on these issues, and also extremely articulate at explaining too. What do you think initially, Martin, then, about this China scenario as a potential nuclear flashpoint?
Well, I agree totally with what he's saying. You'd have thought, with the absolute mess that they've created in the Ukraine, that they would try and avoid having another confrontation with a nuclear-armed superpower. But the maniacs in charge in the West are determined to try and prevent the world changing. Russia and China simply cannot be bullied in the way that Bangladesh or Iraq can. And they've just got to accept it. But they're not accepting it. And the danger is that we will just end up where nobody wants to end up. Nobody actually foresaw war in World War One. Everybody thought that when it came to the crunch, people would back down. But they didn't. And we know what happened. But then they just had, you know, tanks and poison gas and barbed wire. We've now got nuclear weapons.
I mean, there are lots.
You can't afford to mess around with them.
There's lots of potential motives for a third world war. For me, one of the most fascinating and convincing is this whole sort of technique of Albert Pike over many years, who was the boss of Scottish Rite Freemasonry back in the time of the U.S. Civil War. to create these various world wars and actually use it ultimately to bring in a new religion around the world, a kind of new age religion. Fascinating idea, but there's all sorts of other motives as well, not least of which are to do with grabbing resources and finance. But anyway, as a result of chatting about nuclear war there, I think we really ought to bring in a guy called Roland Dye. And I love to pat Roland on the back. He's done a fantastic job, really, because we reported on the last week about the Hiroshima Day commemorations here in Bristol, which was over 4 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, last weekend. And Roland Dye is also someone who spends quite a lot of time, whatever time he can, here from Bristol with his car and his trailer, and off he goes up to Faslane as well. And they've been doing, I think, a brilliant job here, the Bristol Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, in drawing attention to last weekend's anniversary of the explosion of the first two nuclear weapons over in Japan in 1945, at the end of the Pacific War, a couple of months previously. The war in Europe had finished in April, May 1945. And from the investigations that I've done and others have done, not least of which is Carter Heydrich, the author of a book called Critical Mass. And in my book, the book, The Traitors of Arnhem, there's stuff about it in there, in the Martin Bormann timeline, etc., to look at what happened at the end of the Second World War. It looks very likely that, and there is evidence for it, that Nazi enriched uranium, which had been used in their atomic weapons program, which was heading over to Japan. The two Japanese officers on the German submarine, commanded by Dönitz, who was in charge after Hitler died, that submarine then changed its course and went to the east coast of the United States and was used in these bombs, which were dropped on Japan, the two different types of bombs. But anyway, good old Roland Dye and Bristol CND, I asked him he said these Hiroshima, because we said last week, didn't we? We actually played the clip of President Truman saying that Hiroshima was a military base. And here is Roland Dye and Alex Elliott. I'm not sure if we're going to hear from Alex too, talking about these Hiroshima bomb and the Nagasaki bomb both being actually experiments. They were just experiments on civilians to see how many civilians they could kill, burn, destroy, maim, set on fire with these wonderful new toys they got.
Very, very minor military base. There was relatively small contingent of military there, as they would have been in every Japanese town. In fact, they chose cities that had been relatively untouched by previous bombing. These were experiments. The Allies were actually prolonging the war by insisting on surrender conditions that they knew the Japanese wouldn't accept, in order to experiment and drop these two bombs. There were two different technologies on these two cities. So pretty disingenuous. But of course, their propaganda machine rolled out the idea that it shortened the war and it saved lives. But of course, reality is somewhat different.
Yeah. And also, of course, the Russians were about to invade Japan, and this rather forestalled that as well.
Well, also, this was a Dresden all over again. People remember the firebombing of Dresden, which was on the Eastern Front of no military significance whatsoever in Germany. But by firebombing that city, knowing that the Russians were going to overrun that area a week or two later and see the devastation it was caused by Western aerial bombardment. So there was competition between the so-called Allies at that time, and Japan horribly was caught up in that same process. But we do the remembrance, so it's from 8:15, actually on the Saturday morning, through to Nagasaki, which was 2 minutes past 11 on the Tuesday. And what better way to respectfully have an act of remembrance to a quarter of a million dead, rather to talk about the roots of militarism and war and what we can do to campaign against it. So as you see, there were workshops on... Well, basically, Bristol's. This is a coalition of peace groups, XRPs, Bristol, Bristol CND, Bristol Against the Arms Trade, Christian Climate Action, and so on and so forth. So the workshops very much reflect those outlooks.
That's Roland Dye there. I think fascinating, Martin, that they're doing this stuff, but rather irritating, annoying to have this kind of climate business kind of pushing in there, because a lot of the climate people are very pro-nuclear. So what do you make of what Roland was saying there about these being experiments?
Well, it's pretty clear that's what they were. And, there was no real military justification for what they were doing. And, of course, they did discuss whether they should actually nuke the Soviet Union before the Soviet Union had its own nuclear weapons. That's, pretty clear. But, of course, the mainstream mythology is still that it was necessary to save Allied lives and all the rest of it. But the Russians, of course, were prepared to take casualties to conquer Japan. They'd taken far, far more casualties than the Americans had taken. But they were prepared to, to finish the war. They were prepared to, but they would have ended up controlling Japan in that case.
I mean, I get the impression from just looking at the Americans post-war that actually they rather relished the opportunity to test these weapons. They would have been very disappointed. And potentially even Roosevelt might have been elbowed out of the way or even poisoned in order to make way for Truman. Because there was a book called The Decision to Use the Bomb, which said that actually that Roosevelt was actually saying, no, I don't want to use these weapons. And I don't think it's necessary because they're so devastating and horrific. But Truman went along with it. Anyway, look, we're going to hear now the answer to our answer to our question last week. Is Extinction Rebellion embracing nuclear power or not because of the close links to the nuclear weapons industry? From Roland Dye and Alex Elliott, who's one of the campaigners up at Faz Lane.
I'm Alex Elliott, a general nuclear activist, float around Faz Lane Peace Camp and London and places where stuff's going on. So I can say for the UK, maybe not for other countries, I can say with the nuclear, the push with nuclear power because of pricing and political attention will cause a very large deficit on the amount of carbon that we will emit by 2050. And that'll be due to the pricing, the time to build nuclear power, and also the fact that In some cases, it's used to make the weapons itself. Mm. So there's a lot of political pressure and secret stuff going on to proliferate nuclear power for certain elements of weapons.
A lot of the climate stuff, Alex, does tend to focus on nuclear as an actual solution. So I'm not sure how this sits well with the, Hiroshima Day.
I'll just go back to your first point. In general, because of the slowness of nuclear power and the amount of gigawatts you get per billion pounds, which is 8 times more if you do offshore wind, if you take these things into account, what we're now discovering is that these large oil companies are actually promoting nuclear because it means they will be able to sell oil for much longer into this century to Western countries. So there seems to be an underlying push for nuclear, even though...
So how does that work then? How does nuclear help the oil business?
Because it's so expensive and it prolongs renewables being built.
Yeah.
That the time you could have renewables, you're spending all your money on nuclear, which is way more expensive. So it causes a giant deficit in the amount of carbon that will be released. So oil companies like to now promote nuclear and be buddies with nuclear so they can sell oil for longer to create electricity.
Well, what a fascinating take there from Alex Elliott, who you can probably find in the next few weeks anyway, up at the Faz Lane Peace Camp. Martin, it does seem that there is, there's an awareness here that the oil company and the nuclear industry, even though apparently these different forms of energy are competing with each other, they're not really.
Well, I would imagine that there are going to be lots of different, as you know, some Greens are in favour of nuclear power and nuclear energy, not the Greens in Germany, for example. They're totally opposed to it. So, you know, you can't really generalize about what the attitude of climate change activists to nuclear power is. George Monbiot is an outlier. Most of these climate change activists would be on the same page about nuclear weapons. But you can't generalize because in actual fact, they don't have a policy making structure. They're just individuals and groups which have some of their individual and group views. So you can't generalize about what those views might be.
No, you can't really. But, you know, there is definitely a little bit of a battle going on in the peace movement over whether or not to embrace nuclear power or not. Anyway, our final item, as I hinted at a little earlier on, is to do with this whole idea of Albert Pike and his Third World War. I just find it incredible that there's less. I mean, I think there were articles in the Daily Express and in the Daily Mail that look at this character, this fascinating guy from the 1800s who wrote allegedly a letter to Mazzini, Giuseppe Mazzini, who was involved in the unification of Italy into one super state. And many people argue that Albert Pike was unifying the United States of America into one big super state, rather like the United States of Europe or something in Italy. But his idea was the idea of having these various world wars, ultimately to bring about this massive battle, this conflict between Islam and Israel. And this was going to be used and seen with the Christian Zionists getting involved with it too, as such a hideous war as to discredit the monotheistic faith, to discredit the Bible, to discredit Christianity, discredit Judaism, which of course Hitler was quite big on that as well, and in order to bring in this kind of pantheistic religion. So let's have a listen now to David Livingstone's take on this. He's the author of Transhumanism, History of a Dangerous Idea, which you know, he's pointed out that Yuval Noah Harari as well is one of the major cheerleaders for this. In fact, he's called the prophet by people like Zuckerberg and Gates. Yuval Noah Harari, that is, not David Livingstone, sadly. But anyway, this is what David had to say at our Dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order, the Revelation seminar a couple of years ago, organized by Moeen Yassin and Global Vision 2000, about this idea of order from chaos, creating a chaotic Third World War involving all the main monotheistic religions, and then bringing back order, about order from that.
Albert Pike explains that, he says, the apocalypse, that sublime cabalistic and prophetic summary of all the occult figures, divides its images into three septenaries. So this is important, that this happens to be the very same paragraph where Albert Pike reveals his cryptic allegiance to Lucifer. The apocalypse, to those who receive the 19th degree, the apotheosis of the sublime faith, which aspires to God alone and despises all pomps and works of Lucifer. Lucifer, the light bearer, strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness, Lucifer, the son of the morning. Why he's calling us out in the morning there is because typically Lucifer is identified with Venus, and that's where you're going back to the worship of the goddess. So basically what Albert Pike is explaining, the purpose of his book, Morals and Dogma, which is considered the Bible of Freemasonry, is to explain that the purpose of Freemasonry is to rebuild the temple. So as I mentioned, the temple was rebuilt when the Jews returned to Babylon, but it was then again destroyed with the conquest of the Romans in 70 AD. So the goal of Freemasonry, the goal of the occult, is to, and the expectations for the end times, is that a third temple is going to be constructed. So the goal of Freemasonry is to build, allegorically rebuild, the third temple, which is why they're called Freemasons. And because they're going to bring about the coming of the Messiah. And that is what they call the great work, the magnum opus. And it's all based on the Book of Revelation, which is effectively their blueprint.
That's David Livingstone there. We'll have some more from him next week. But Martin, before we go, this whole idea of the Third Temple is actually very important, isn't it, in the present day right now. It's a potential flashpoint, as David says there.
Well, it is, but not necessarily in the more convoluted way in which he's explaining it. You've got the, you know, there are the Al-Aqsa Mosque the Israelis are attempting to, you know, basically put this, take it over.
And they want to demolish it, don't they?
Well, they're not saying that they want to demolish it, but of course that there is a far right groups within Israel probably do. But of course the Palestinians see it very much as, you know, this thus far and no further. And of course the you know, we've had the recent attacks on Gaza, which we haven't really covered. But of course when the uprising happened last year, for the first time, you got loads of fighting between different groups within Israel, and not just in Gaza or the West Bank, but Arabs that live inside Israel ending up in confrontation with the security forces and lots of people being killed. And talking of nuclear wars, another potential nuclear war is right there in the Middle East. We've taken our eyes off the ball there.
This is one of the workshops that Roland had at his part of his Hiroshima Day, was about Israel's 200 or so nuclear weapons. We keep hearing about Iran, but we don't hear much about them. I mean, I think you're right. We should put in a word for the Palestinians. I mean, this was a horrific few days. I noticed, I mean, basically the Israeli attack started roughly when our program was going out on Friday evening, early evening on Friday, late afternoon, just as all of the London journalists and the, you know, other people in Europe, other journalists were going home. And of course, there was a ceasefire signed on the Sunday evening, just before everyone came back for work on Monday. It's rather cynical, isn't it, to conduct your assassinations, your killings, your genocide in adverse proportion to the number of journalists in Europe's newsrooms that might be covering it.
Well, you can't rely on that. I mean, basically, it was covered, but in terms of preemptive strike by Israel on Islamic Jihad, they didn't present any evidence whatsoever that Islamic Jihad were planning to do anything. And of course, because it was on a Friday, they attacked lots of people in mosques and they've killed 19 children.
Absolutely
so,
horrific.
You know, when do we start sending weapons to the Palestinians? Well, maybe they need some of these HIMARS, which the Ukrainians have got, so that they can hit back. Few billions of weapons, I'd say.
Mark, the other big story of the week we haven't covered is the raid on Trump's house. A couple of facts to do with that is that the raid took place just 1 day before the deadline for the midterm elections, because you're not allowed to do political raids of any sort in the United States that within certain periods before elections, because they know, as happened in places like Montenegro, that if you arrest one of the candidates on the day of the election, it's all over the news, then people are less likely to vote for them. And so actually it's the news people who are deciding and the police who are deciding who gets elected. And the other fact, which I've gleaned from some of my looking at the US sites, is that this secret document which Trump seems to have, which may actually be very damaging if he uses it in another election campaign of some sort, which the FBI want back, it could be a document which he is not declassified officially. But anyway, they were looking in his safe at his house for it, and apparently the safe was empty. Trump seems to be one step ahead of them.
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know all the detail about what's going on there. You know, the culture wars in the US go on. And of course,
this is nothing to do with culture wars. This is a raid unprecedented on a former president's home and on his safe.
Yes, this is the United States, where the serving president, John F. Kennedy, is assassinated by his own security forces, where the 9/11 attack is carried out by the deep state. And of course, all the Trumpites who are getting worked up about this. Trump is basically a criminal. And
you're cheerleading for Biden here, aren't you?
No, I'm not cheerleading for Biden.
Yes, you are.
I think the whole U.S. political system is utterly corrupt. The people who support Alex Jones pointed out that 9/11 was an inside job. What did Trump do about that when he was in power? He did nothing. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
It's okay for the FBI. Well, why don't the FBI just arrest sitting presidents then and just take the country over themselves?
The actual fact, the FBI has created most of the terrorism inside the United States for years. They're a totally corrupt organization, but Trump is another totally corrupt politician. Biden.
My thoughts about this are pretty simple. Well, if Trump manages to survive these various attacks on him by the deep state, then he's more likely actually to win the next presidential election because of these various abuses of power. I mean, what the hell are they playing at?
Well, it's a possibility, and the Democrats may, if they are behind this, may regret what they've done. But there's no salvation there on either side. There is nobody. Bernie Sanders should have won the nomination and stood against Trump, and he would have won. And then we might have had a chance of doing something. Jeremy Corbyn should have been given a fair go here, and then we can perhaps move the world a few steps forward. But as things stand at the moment, there is going to be a massive crisis and breakdown, and nobody, Trump, Biden, is going to be able to do anything about it.
Well, he died about 120 years ago. It seems Albert Pike and his Scottish Rite Freemasons are still running the show. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bozenko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, our email addresses, and you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We were talking there about the end of the Second World War, the Nazi uranium going to the US to use in the bombs, in fact, on Japan. My paperback book about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. It costs £15. And also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're all on eBay. You can get them there or bookfinder.com. Just put in my name, Tony Gosling, author, and the Siege of Heaven ebook. And all links to all of those are via www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, which is actually now called something slightly different, because PRSC didn't want us to call it the PRSC stream. And that was at talkradio.org.uk. When we are restreaming also the Richie Allen show and over Sunday lunch, you can make live recordings of those too. So we've been streaming live online from Bristol and from Herefordshire on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. The glorious BCFM Politics show, not the BCFM Politics show app. Apparently this weekend it might be available from the Apple Store, but Google seemed to have censored it. I'm still trying to find out from the developer what's going on with that. It was around for a while. Maybe it will be one of those things that you can get on the black market, you know, not the BCFM show app. Who knows? And censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk, on our website at thisweek.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let Albert Pike's Illuminati banksters get you down.
My tears are falling rain, for the carnival is over, we may never meet again.
Like a drum, my heart was beating, and your kiss was sweet as wine.
the joys of love are fleeting. For Pierrot and Columbine, now the harbor light is calling. This will be our last goodbye, though the carnival is on.